You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening here.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man gone over there.
Because, well, ultimately this is a scientific issue. Are vaccines safe? Are they effective? Are they necessary? Are there other things we can do? That's all science questions. The way it plays out in our lives day to day is a legal question. At any given point in time, when somebody's required to get a vaccine, there's either a law that says you can say no or there isn't. So where the rubber meets the road primarily is in the state legislature. So we've got to become legislatively involved, whether we like that or not. And we've got to be proactive, pushing our agenda for informed choice, because whether we do that or not, they're pushing their agenda backed by huge sums of money and lobbyists and so forth.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Alan Phillips. Today's show, Vaccines, Threads of Corruption. Alan Phillips is a practicing attorney headquartered in North Carolina. He is a nationally recognized legal expert on vaccine policy and law. He is the only attorney in the United States whose practice is focused solely on vaccine exemptions and waivers and vaccine legislative activism. He advises individuals, families, attorneys, legislators, and legislative activists throughout the U.S. on vaccine exemption and waiver rights and vaccine politics and law. He hosts a weekly radio show, The Vaccine Agenda. He is the author of The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, published as an ebook. Guns and Butter co-producer Tony Rango caught up with Alan Phillips for an update on the current vaccination legal and political environment, its effects on doctors and healthcare workers, students and employees, as well as related industries, including medical publishing and pharmaceuticals. We begin with the 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act that granted legal protection to the vaccine industry.
Alan Phillips, welcome to Guns and Butter.
Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here.
You are in a very unique position to discuss vaccine exemptions, since you are the only lawyer in the U.S. with a practice that focuses specifically on legal exemptions. And I know there's a lot you have to share with our listeners on this topic, especially in light of recent California legislation mandating vaccines, SB 277 for children and SB 792 for adults. There are two areas. The first is corruption, an area you've been covering lately. The other is legal and legislative issues, which also include exemptions. Take us through the legal environment in which the vaccine industry operates that provides opportunity and what appears to be incentive to be corrupted. What did the 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act change?
Well, first of all, we need to understand why that 1986 Act was passed. And the pharmaceutical industry was going out of business, not the pharmaceutical industry, but the vaccine manufacturing portion of the pharmaceutical industry. It was going out of business in the early 1980s, mid-1980s. They were pulling out of the vaccine business. There was the court awards for vaccine injury and death were too many and too high. And Congress stepped in to save that industry. We really have to question, I think, whether there was a need to save anything there. But this was all on kind of this broad premise about how vaccines are necessary. That's an irrefutable fact, so we're not even going to debate that. Because if it weren't for vaccines, we'd have rampant disease running everywhere and so forth. If you look at the official government statistics, and not only here in the U.S., but also in Great Britain, in Australia, and probably some other countries as well, the mortality decline from childhood infectious diseases dropped steadily across the 1900s, a period of decades. And that drop was on average about 90 to 90% before vaccines were even introduced in the first place. So vaccines may have had and may have some impact on disease incidence, but not on disease mortality. We do not have low disease death rates with regard to the childhood infectious diseases today because of vaccines. Vaccines had nothing to do with that. The vast majority of that decline preceded the introduction of vaccines. So I would question the need for anybody to do anything, decide to try and protect the vaccine industry. If their products don't stand on their own merits, they should either fix the products or get out of the business. And there's a whole other category question about whether or not there are other ways of dealing with childhood infectious diseases. And I'll just mention very, very briefly, because I think it's such an important one that needs to become a bigger part of this conversation. And that is homeoprophylaxis, which is a very particular type of homeopathic remedy that has demonstrated quite successfully in parts of India and in Cuba, among other places in recent years, where they have used homeoprophylaxis on literally millions of people and documented scientifically the results and seen that it has been very effective. And it's a fraction of the cost of conventional allopathic immunizations. It's more effective, and it doesn't have a side effect of injury and death. We know that vaccines cause injury and death. The federal government pays out money every year. Over the last 6 years, the average payout was over $220 million a year, and that's about twice the average annual payout over the life of the program, which is now, in its 26th year of paying out money to compensate victims of vaccines. And that number's enormous, Tony, but we know from multiple sources, including people from the FDA and the CDC, but also non-governmental agencies such as the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons and the National Vaccine Information Center, which has conducted independent surveys, we know that roughly only 1 to 10% of the serious vaccine adverse events ever even get reported. And this is not only a serious problem in that it means there's literally no data available for anyone to use to calculate whether there's any net benefit from vaccines. The cynical but informed among us would say that's not an accident, because we see people in the healthcare industry deliberately violating federal laws. A part of that 1986 Act, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, included federal statutes requiring anybody administering a vaccine to give a physical piece of paper to the vaccine recipient or the parent if it's a minor that's being vaccinated. That spells out not only the supposed risks and benefits of vaccines, but more importantly, for purposes of this point, the existence of the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, which is one of the things that 1986 Act created. And this is a program that compensates people or families of people who are injured or killed by vaccines. So the vast majority of the injuries and deaths from vaccines are probably not even being reported at all. Again, we have multiple sources, governmental and non-governmental agencies, agreeing, at least in general terms, that the vast majority never even gets reported. We have laws that require doctors, again, another part of this 1986 Act, anyone administering a vaccine, if they see certain events in terms of medical conditions show up within a certain period of time after a vaccine, and has nothing to do with whether the doctor thinks the vaccine has anything to do with it or not. It's not about their professional opinion. If this condition shows up in this amount of time after a vaccine, it has to be reported. And anything in the package inserts listed as a side effect, if that shows up, it has to be reported. And yet the majority of doctors are not reporting.
I've never had a doctor say anything like that to me or give me any information ahead of time. Is that pretty standard, or what's your sense on that?
Well, surveys show that most doctors don't do that, and anecdotal evidence I hear over and over again from people like yourself just now who say no, they've never offered a piece of paper. When my oldest son went in for his first immunization, this would have been over 22 years ago or about 22 years ago, we were handed a piece of paper, and at that point in time, I was not an attorney, and I wasn't familiar with this law. I wasn't even aware of vaccine injury or death as a potential reality at that point in time. But I now know, looking back, that the piece of paper the doctor gave me was something he was required by law to give me. But maybe they were more consistent back then, or maybe I just had one of the few who actually did it. But this doctor, you know, it's real interesting. He was out of the room for some period of time for one reason or another, and he came back in, and I had read this paper while he was gone. And I said, "Doctor, it says here that my son's chance of dying from pertussis is 1 in 10 million, but his chance of a serious adverse reaction are about 1 in 1750. And he got very angry with me and raised his voice and was close to yelling at me. And as he says, "It doesn't say that." And he storms out of the room. And as he's closing the door, he says, "I guess I should read that sometime."
Sorry for laughing. I was going to say my understanding is, and what happens in the media instead of actually reporting these, is they demonize the parent who brings in their child who maybe has been vaccine injured to ask that question. And they're ridiculed and told that can't be possible.
Well, to be fair, I rarely have people ever call me up and say, "By the way, I want you to know that everything went smoothly and beautifully. Thanks for being there." You know, people contact me when they have problems. But certainly I hear anecdotally over and over again reports along the lines of what you just described, that many doctors, who knows how many, but many, it's certainly common, are for some reason on this issue, it pulls them out of professional behavior. I don't think it's an accident, frankly, and because what I've heard from several doctors about medical school, they say, "We're not taught anything about vaccines in medical school except here's the schedule, and vaccines are safe, and by the way, here are some pictures of children dying from these infectious diseases, this is why we need vaccines." So there's an emotional or psychological programming going on. And what doctors have implanted in them at an emotional level is these horrible pictures of children dying from these infectious diseases. And let's not make any mistakes. These infectious diseases have been horrible killers in decades past. You know, 100 years ago, a significant number of children died from and prior to that time from these infectious diseases. So they certainly have been problems in the past. But what we are not told, because it's not good marketing, is the fact that the death from these diseases, the death rate declined steadily for decades before vaccines ever came on the scene. So where we are today, you know, before the measles vaccine was first introduced in the years immediately preceding that, the measles was nothing more than a cold with spots. I mean, it was not regarded as something that anybody should be concerned about. Okay, you're sick. Good. Now you'll be done with it. Unlike a cold, it's something you get once and you're done with it. And so it was actually a good thing to get it. And we now know from medical research that getting measles and mumps and these childhood diseases actually protects from certain kinds of cancers and other chronic diseases later on in life. So it's beneficial to get, especially as a child, these childhood infectious diseases. And there was no problem with getting them until after there was a vaccine available. And then for marketing reasons, they had to change the image of these diseases to make them something terrible and awful to be feared.
Now it seems like it's a life-threatening epidemic to get it.
Right. It's not a life-threatening epidemic to get any of these diseases that they don't have a vaccine for. But the ones they have a vaccine for, they suddenly become life-threatening because there's a vaccine. We need to understand that vaccine policy and law is driven by mainstream medicine. And mainstream medicine, for whatever good that it does and includes and has, is also severely and substantially corrupt. And it's corrupt in the sense that it has been skewed by the pharmaceutical industry's influence over state and federal legislatures and health departments to skew policy and law to favor them from a marketing point of view. Because not only are vaccines now a multi-billion dollar industry, and again, no liability, virtually no liability for all practical purposes, but vaccines are introducing chronic disease into the population, and everyone who develops a chronic disease from a vaccine and it doesn't kill them then is potentially a lifelong customer for other pharmaceutical products.
You're listening to vaccine exemption attorney Ellen Phillips, interviewed by Tony Rango. Today's show, Vaccines, Threads of Corruption. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
We need to understand that psychopaths make up a certain percentage of the population. I've seen different figures ranging from 4 to 8%. And every psychopath is not a serial killer. Some of these people are intellectually brilliant, and they learn at a very early age how to act appropriately, even though they have no conscience themselves. They can see and imitate and learn how to act. And some of these people will rise up the corporate ladder or the government ladder to key decision-making positions and, in fact, have done so. So the evidence of this is not simply conspiracy theory. There's objective evidence for this. The pharmaceutical industry routinely engages as just a matter of business practice in massive criminal behavior. There have been combined criminal civil fines, $100 million and up, as high as $3 billion or more, at least 33, 34 times since 2001. That's just the ones above 100 million. You know, I don't have the time to go researching all the ones that were only in the millions or hundreds, thousands or whatever. And criminal fines have been in the hundreds of millions of dollars and even as high as $1 billion, the criminal portion of these larger combined criminal civil fines. This is an industry that routinely engages in massive criminal behavior, as documented. Anybody can go to the Justice Department website and look it up. It's right there for anybody to go see who wants to take the time to do that. So the question is, why do they do that? Well, for three simple reasons. One, nobody goes to jail. There's nobody that's held accountable in the way that people are ordinarily held accountable in our society for criminal behavior. Two, there's a net profit. They wouldn't do this unless there was a net profit. And the behavior has gotten worse. If you look at the size and frequency and number of these fines, they have gotten larger and larger over the last several years compared to prior years. So the problem's getting worse and worse. And they wouldn't do it unless there was a net profit. So there's a net profit. And then again, the third reason, because the people who are making these decisions, and I'm not rendering a diagnosis here, I'm using labels to make a point. They're either sociopaths or psychopaths. And what I mean by that is they lack a conscience. They lack the ability to refrain from engaging in behavior, even though it's profitable, because it's going to cause some unnecessary deaths and disability. But when you make those kinds of decisions in the healthcare arena, well, at least the way the legal system is set up right now, these people, they pay fines when they get caught. Who knows how many times they do things and don't get caught. But when they get caught, yes, they'll pay fines, and sometimes some pretty heavy fines. I'm not suggesting that in 2012, for example, when GlaxoSmithKline paid a $3 billion fine, $1 billion criminal, $2 billion civil, I'm not suggesting they were happy. But there is this, to use a quick analogy, a little skit on the Laugh-In show two or three decades ago. The old lady comes into the pharmacy and she asks for her prescription, and the pharmacist says, "That'll be $5. You can tell how long ago it was now, right? He says, "That'll be $5. And then the phone rings and he picks up the phone and starts talking. Well, the little old lady pulls out two quarters and waves in front of the guy, but he's busy on the phone, doesn't see her. She sets the two quarters down on the counter and walks out. The pharmacist gets off the phone, looks down and sees 50 cents. And he says, he yells out to the lady, "No, lady, that wasn't 50 cents. It's $5. But she's already gone. And then the punchline is, "Oh, well, quarter profit's better than none." So, you know, it's like, who cares if you pay a $3 billion fine if there's a $20 billion profit? And the World Health Organization back in 2009 estimated that developed nations individually, this is not collectively, individually, on average, probably have about $23 billion of corrupt healthcare practice going on. And I saw an estimate, more recent estimate, talking about the U.S. specifically, estimating something more in the range of $60 billion. In 2014, or at the end of 2014, the Justice Department bragged that during 2014, they had recovered $3.3 billion. And let's give credit where credit is due. That's a lot of money to get back from the pharmaceutical industry. But if they're doing $23 billion or maybe $60 billion, depending on, you know, whose estimate you look at, that's one heck of a net profit. So the industry certainly doesn't want to pay fines if they can get away with it. But when you got that kind of a net profit, the only thing that's going to stop somebody at that point is if they have a conscience and realize that, hey, it's not okay to engage in behavior that creates unnecessary death and disability, or is even just morally or ethically wrong. So we need to understand that there are people in key decision-making positions who will make decisions that hurt, injure, and kill people, so long as there's a net profit and they are not being directly held accountable for it. There are people who will do that. There are people who have been doing it and are doing it as we speak. And once we get over this hump of, well, nobody would really do that, then we can get to a place where we can really look at the problem and start to take some steps to address it.
Right. And you mentioned this accountability, quote unquote, for the pharmaceuticals, but this is somewhat accountability because those companies are setting that money aside and the shareholders are paying. So there is not really accountability, but that doesn't even exist with vaccines. You and I are paying that with our taxpayer funds that go into the system. Isn't that correct?
Well, the way they have it structured and labeled, it's a tax that the manufacturer pays, 75 cents on every vaccine. But do you think they take that out of their profit, or do you think they just add it on to the cost of the vaccine? So, you know, whether you want to say they pay for it or we pay for it sort of depends on how you want to look at it. And then, you know, who buys the vaccines? You and I do. So we're paying that tax in the cost of vaccines, whether it's the government. State and federal governments, of course, purchase vaccines and administer vaccines, but, you know, private citizens do as well. So it's some combination. But any way you want to look at it, it's not like they're, you know, taking that out of their bottom line and just, you know, taking a hit for the common good. That's not the way this works. So yeah, at the end of the day, it's the taxpayers who are paying this net money. The tax that on each vaccine, it goes into a federal government fund that then is where the money comes from to compensate through the Vaccine Energy Compensation Program victims of vaccines or their families.
Which, when there is criminal or quasi-criminal behavior, that is not impacting the actual manufacturers of the vaccines or the doctors themselves that are administering it.
Well, part of this 1986 Act requires vaccine manufacturers to take steps to make safer vaccines, but there's no enforcement mechanism. They're in this program happy to have the program that significantly removed liability when the act was passed in 1986, but then we had a 2011 U.S. Supreme Court case that took it even further, that basically said there's virtually no liability now. And originally, the law said you have to go to this federal program first. And if you don't like the results of that, then you can go to state court and sue just like you would any other personal injury case. But the U.S. Supreme Court interpreted the language in the law in such a way as to say, no, you really can't do that anymore. Again, for all practical purposes, it is the first and last stop now. And, you know, I said earlier, doctors are required to give information to vaccine recipients or their parents informing people of this program. Well, they're not doing that. And there are today roughly 140, 150 attorneys around the country who do these vaccine injury compensation cases. And by the way, for all people listening to this, there is no cost to hire one of these attorneys. The government pays the attorneys on both sides in these cases, and there are people representing themselves because they can't afford an attorney, and they don't realize you don't have to afford an attorney. So you always want to have an attorney whenever you can with any important legal matter, because unfortunately the legal system is complex, and there are a lot of people with winning cases who lose because they don't know how to navigate the legal system. And unfortunately, it's a complex system, and it really helps to have an expert guide you through that system or represent you through the system, especially with vaccine injury compensation.
Well, let's go back to the corruption in science. I want to talk a little bit more about that. And what other ways has science and research been corrupted? And maybe tell us a little about Dr. Thompson and what he has revealed.
Well, let me back up a step on a couple of points here. I want to talk about just a little bit about the medical publishing industry, because what doctors rely on, very few doctors have time, and medical students even less time, to actually go out and do medical research on vaccines or anything else for that matter. And when they can find time to read the medical journals, they'll look at the conclusions, and that's what they base their practice in large part on. Or the CDC or other governmental, non-governmental agencies will often look to the medical literature, and that can drive to a large extent what goes on. Now, the point I'm about to get to is separate and apart from the idea of cherry picking, which goes on considerably, where you look at the studies that say what you want them to say and you ignore the studies that don't say what you want them to say. Somehow those studies are either non-existent or they're wrong by default, because if you have a preconceived conclusion rather than looking objectively to see whether or not there's consensus in the medical literature, and if so, what it is, and if there's not consensus, what are the conflicting points and why, and so forth. Doctors don't have the time to get into that. So a couple of comments here from three different people who are either in or have been in the heart of the mainstream medical publishing world. And the first quote here comes from Dr. Marcia Angel from Harvard University. And she was an editor for the New England Journal of Medicine for 20 years. And she went public, I think it was back in 2004. It's been several years ago now. She said it's simply no longer possible to believe much of the clinical research that is published or to rely on the judgment of trusted physicians and authoritative medical guidelines. And she was very reluctant to say this. She says, I take no pleasure in this conclusion, which I reached slowly and reluctantly over my two decades as an editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. And she wrote a book called The Truth About the Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us and What to Do About It. It comes from somebody who's as much a mainstream insider as you could be, or certainly she was. Another quote here. This comes from a gentleman by the name of John Ioannidis. And he wrote something in 2005, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. And he says in the abstract of this article, simulations show that for most study designs and settings, it's more likely for a research claim to be false than true. And that for many current scientific fields, research findings may simply be accurate measures of the prevailing bias. Going to the comment I was saying there, that there seems to be a tendency to, when you want to assert a point of view, you cherry pick. Now, you know, what did Dr. Angel say in articles I've read about hers and probably gets into in depth in her book? And in one sense, it's sort of simple. It's just that money is driving what gets published and what the published research says rather than objective science. You publish a study and it either supports or doesn't support a new drug, and millions, if not $1 billion or more, can be on the line there. And there's just something about money when it reaches a certain level that it takes on a life of its own and it rolls over anything in its path. And whether it's because people have a phenomenally myopic vision and can't or refuse to see the moral and ethical issues and lines, and even outright civil and criminal legal lines, or because they just deliberately choose to roll over it anyway, who knows in any given situation. But that is, in fact, what's happening, is that these lines are being rolled over. And more recently, just last year, the same fellow, Dr. Ioannidis, says, currently many published research findings are false or exaggerated, and an estimated 85% of research resources are wasted. And I would add wasted maybe with respect to objective science, but probably otherwise very carefully targeted to sell products.
You're listening to vaccine exemption attorney Ellen Phillips, interviewed by Tony Rango. Today's show, Vaccines, Threads of Corruption. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
I want to take it one step further, because this comes from earlier this year. Richard Horton, who is the editor-in-chief of The Lancet. This is one of the most respected and prestigious medical journals on the planet, as is the New England Journal of Medicine that Marcia Angel used to work for as well. But here's Richard Horton, editor-in-chief of The Lancet. He says, the case against science is straightforward. Much of the scientific literature, perhaps half, may simply be untrue. He gives a quick list of some of the reasons for this, but the end phrase here is very telling, Tony. He says, science has taken a turn towards darkness. Now, this is not the kind of language that somebody who's the editor-in-chief of a prestigious medical journal uses. Science has taken a turn toward darkness. That's just not, you know, that's not a scientific phrase or even an intellectual kind of phrase. To me, this is a cry for help. Science has taken a turn towards darkness. He sees something that is totally out of control and just doesn't have any other way to phrase it. This is my interpretation, but I can't come up with any other explanation for this, that phrase, science has taken a turn towards darkness. That's a cry for help. But some of it gets just downright absurd. There was a Harvard science journalist who submitted 304 versions of a fraudulent research paper to open access journals, and more than half of the journals accepted the paper for publication. You know, what kind of a world do we live in when you can make up a study and somebody will publish it? But it gets even more absurd. I'm going to take it one step further. This is from an article in MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT News, in April of this year, 2015, how three MIT students fooled the world of scientific journals. These three students wrote a computer program that they called SciGen, S-C-I-G-E-N, SciGen. This computer program generates random computer science papers, complete with realistic-looking graphs and figures and citations, but it's just random. It invents made-up science papers, and they've actually had these papers be accepted. One paper was accepted for a presentation in a conference. And there was a situation a couple of years ago where the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers and Springer Publishing, they removed more than 120 papers from their websites after a French researcher's analysis determined that more than 120 papers were generated by SciGen, a computer science program that was written just as a joke. Now, they had to be really good. These must have been really convincing-looking fake studies, you know, to be accepted. But how could anybody read a fake study and then not recognize that it's a fake study, you know, randomly generated? So this is the point here. We're at a place where scientific publishing is a joke. And I'm sorry to say that, because I'm sure there are many credible researchers with high integrity who do serious work, submit it for publishing, and get published. So I'm not saying that that doesn't ever happen. But what is also happening is that you could just make up studies, and a lot of times they'll still get published. Or you can even have a computer program invent random arbitrary studies and they get published. This is a very sad state of affairs that we're in. And all this comes back to a real simple but profound point. We want to bring it back into vaccines specifically and medical publishing. If the medical literature is not reliable, and clearly based on what I've just said, it's not, then who should have the final decision making for you and your kids, and when it comes to healthcare issues, you or the state or your employer or anybody who's going to rely on this fraudulent research that's out there, or potentially fraudulent research, unreliable research?
I heard about those different studies and things you mentioned, and it's truly amazing, and I think darkness captures it quite well.
Right. Well, This sort of leads into another question here. You know, the vaccine policy and law, in fact, healthcare policy and law generally, is driven by mainstream medicine. So this gets into the question of, you know, why did we fail with SB 277 and another bill in Illinois that passed that is the most egregious religious exemption law I've ever seen in the country now in Illinois. And we had some, you know, wonderful successes in other parts of the country, but, you know, they're going to come back better organized and better strategies. And, you know, we've got our work cut out for us here. But There's a real important distinction, especially with respect to talking with legislators, trying to educate them on the issue, in my opinion. And the distinction has to do with the difference between what has been officially documented and what hasn't. What I'm saying for purposes of educating legislators, your better starting points are the already confirmed, officially, formally documented things, such as the fines that have been assessed and paid, for example. You know, you show a legislator, and I've started putting some of this information in graphs so you can look at it and see it as a picture, and it just, you know, the old saying, a picture speaks a thousand words or whatever it is, really can hold true for some of these vaccine issues. You look at a graph, and I've put one of these together just in the last few days, of the payouts year to year from the vaccine compensation program, and there's all these tall bars on the right side of the graph, because in the last 6 years, the payout amounts have skyrocketed compared to all the prior years. The average in the last 6 years, over twice the average across the duration of the whole program. You look at a graph of the criminal and civil fines in the pharmaceutical industry that are above $100 million over the last, say, 15 years, and you see in the last several years, 6, 7, 8 years, you see these bars on the right side that are way taller than all the bars on the left side, and you see that the combined criminal fines are in the multi-billions of dollars over the, in the last several years, whereas they were only in the hundreds of millions of dollars in preceding years. So, you know, you sometimes a graph just really communicates better than, you know, giving a study or writing a paragraph or whatever.
You've also been working with a lot of healthcare workers as well over the past number of years, certainly as the pressure's been increasing. What kind of success have you been having with exemptions and getting them support with their jobs?
Well, based on what my clients have been telling me, and I've heard this from at least three different clients where different parts of the country, where they say our hospital system has had over 1,000 requests for exemptions, or over 1,500 in one instance. The hospital administrators brag that they only allowed, you know, 4 exemptions in one case, or very few or no exemptions. So they offer exemptions, but they don't really want to grant any. What I see in my practice is that the vast majority of my healthcare worker clients will get the exemptions, high 90s. I haven't kept track of it specifically, you know, and documented, but the vast majority of them do. When people don't get an exemption, if they have come to me up front and they're working with me up front, as opposed to trying it on their own and then they get rejected, because a lot of times people have unwittingly, of course, shot themselves in the foot, and it can be really more difficult in those situations. But the people who come to me up front from the start will almost always, if not always, end up with a qualifying exemption. The question then becomes, does the employer cooperate or not? And the problem with any vaccine exemption arena is that the people on the other side have the leverage. If they want to make you jump through hoops to enforce your rights, they can do that. And so the question then becomes, when that happens, how far is my client willing to go? So the few instances where I've had clients who didn't get an exemption, it's usually because they stopped fighting at some point, even though they had a winning position. They didn't want to pay me, or didn't have money to pay me to take it to the next step. Or they go to the EEOC, for example, which is where you go if you have a dispute with an employer about a religious exemption, and you want to take it to the next step formally. Maybe if the EEOC doesn't get it right, you can go to court then, but people don't have the money or the emotional stamina or whatever it is to go to court. So I've had clients with winning cases that just stopped at some point for whatever reason. But again, the vast majority of them in this arena are successful. And my impression is, from my clients tell me, is that the vast majority who aren't getting legal help are not successful. And because people on both sides of the issue don't understand how it works legally.
Right. So you're able to help these folks more with the federal religious exemption rather than working with families, say, in California, who are dealing with state exemption issues. Is that correct?
Well, I work with clients and, when necessary, local attorneys around the country. And whether it's state law or federal law or a mixture, just depends on, you know, the specific situation. There's a long list of different categories where exemption issues come up, and most people don't realize. I didn't realize it when I first got into this work, how vast, broad, and deep it is. But vaccines are required at birth, for school and daycare enrollment, for college enrollment, increasingly at work, in the military, and that can involve military members, families, and civilian contractors, for immigrants, which could include foreign adopted children. Another issue I see coming up more and more in my practice is where parents divorce or split up and disagree about whether or not to vaccinate the kids, and the legal arguments there are completely different from other child custody disputes, and family law attorneys just don't see that. And I've spoken now with dozens of family law attorneys around the country, and I've never talked to one who knew what I had to share with them before we got on the phone and talked about it. It's not because I'm smarter than any of them, but I've just been focused on this issue for years and years, and you know, they're seeing it for the first time when it comes up there. So just a lot of different arenas where vaccines are required, and you've got to understand what law applies and how it applies and what the exemptions are. And, you know, in terms of exemptions for school and daycare, for example, it varies from state to state because the federal government doesn't have authority to mandate vaccines for state residents. But with employers and employees, there are only three states that have state exemption laws that would apply to any healthcare workers or employees. So most states don't have a state law at all that can help them in that arena, but federal civil rights law can help them. And it's not about a vaccine religious exemption per se. It's about religious discrimination in the workplace. But the law can function for practical purposes like a vaccine religious exemption. So you just have to understand what situation you're in, what the starting place is in terms of the law, and often it's a mixture of state and federal law, because anytime, for example, there's a religious exemption that brings in federal constitutional free exercise of religion rights and so forth.
You're listening to vaccine exemption attorney Ellen Phillips, interviewed by Tony Rango. Today's show, Vaccines, Threads of Corruption. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Let's switch gears a little bit and go back to California. I wanted to get on the SB 277. You said you had some advice for parents regarding that as far as an approach goes, either for other states or for parents in California. What's your thoughts?
Well, first of all, just the obligatory disclaimer, I'm not offering legal advice on the air here. I'm just offering information for general educational purposes. But I would point out that the language in SB 277 refers to a letter or affidavit that if you get into the daycare or school before January 1st, 2016, then you can preserve your right to continue exercising the personal belief exemption under the old law until the child reaches either kindergarten or seventh grade. So people whose child is going into kindergarten or seventh grade next fall, I think are out of luck unless they're going to homeschool or leave the state, frankly. But a lot of people are saying, make sure you have a personal belief exemption in to preserve your right under the old law. And I'm not asserting one way or the other. I'm just raising a question. I don't know whether a personal belief exemption falls under this label of letter or affidavit. So if it were me and I lived in California, I would write a letter and I would get it notarized, which is what makes a document an affidavit, or I would label it affidavit. I would make sure that I had a letter or affidavit, is what I'm saying. It may be that the personal belief form under the old law counts as a letter or affidavit, but I'm not sure if it does. So I'm just raising that question. But there's an aspect of this new law, Tony, that is really fascinating, and that's that it rewrites the medical exemption, and it's incredibly broad. It really puts the total authority in the hands of medical doctors, and without restricting them by saying you have to meet this condition or this criteria in a specific way. It's very general language, which leaves it pretty wide open for doctors to exercise their professional discretion, and that's the end of the story. So I don't know whether doctors who write medical exemptions are going to be you know, there can be some consequence for that politically or, you know, some kind of pressure. But the language of the law gives the doctor pretty much total authority to decide.
Yeah, and that raises actually a question I had. Have you heard of doctors getting punished for not sticking to certain vaccination schedules or getting an incentive to have a higher vaccination rate or compliance rate? Is there any kind of incentive or coercion techniques?
When you have these enormous financial interests and people who are able and willing to do anything to protect those interests and further those interests, you know, you risk some negative feedback when you start messing with those interests. And the vaccine industry, it was really interesting that somebody else had to sort of bring this to my attention. The vaccine injury compensation program in that 1986 law substantially removes liability for manufacturers or anyone administering vaccines for the death and disability that's caused by vaccines. But your vaccine has to be on the list. So the industry has been making this aggressive shift away from whatever else they do and into the vaccine arena where they have limited liability. And so there are all kinds of things now, treatments that are being developed, they're being called vaccines that have nothing to do with childhood infectious diseases. There are vaccines under development for obesity, for cocaine addiction, you know, for things you would never think of as having to do with the vaccine. And if it has anything to do with the immune system, I guess they can call it a vaccine. And then if they can get it on the vaccine list, they'll have no liability for it. And, you know, the patents on a lot of the blockbuster drugs have recently run out or are running out. And so they're looking for another basket to put their eggs in. And they're putting it in the vaccine basket. So the push for flu vaccines is just a door opener. The CDC has been saying for years already that they want to revaccinate every adult with all the childhood vaccines. But there are literally hundreds of new vaccines in development. I heard a figure over 270 vaccines, and this was several months ago now, that were already at the FDA waiting for approval or licensure. Vaccines have to be licensed by the FDA before they can be administered in the U.S., or they were in clinical trials, the last stages before going to the FDA. So there's just this enormous shift into the vaccine arena and away from other places where the profits are not as big and the liability is still there. So this is a disturbing progression, because we're going to see more and more kinds of vaccines developed or things called vaccines that you would never think of as having anything to do with vaccines, so that they can get into this no liability arena. And every man, woman, and child on the planet is a potential recipient of vaccines from the moment of birth until somewhere up to, what, a year after you die, you're supposed to keep getting flu shots now, I think. You know, I mean, it might as well be. It's as ridiculous as all this is, and there's just no limit to the number of vaccines, as far as the industry is concerned, that any person can get at any stage and age in their life. And the reason they're requiring healthcare workers to get flu vaccines is the healthcare workers are the door opener to the rest of the adult population. We're supposed to all look at the healthcare workers and say, oh, they're the health professionals, they're all getting flu shots, it must be good, I better go get my flu shot. And, of course, they'll conveniently leave out the part that the reason that they're getting these shots is because they'd lose their jobs if they didn't. And then the flu vaccine, a door opener to literally hundreds of new vaccines to come. So it's an open-ended agenda. There's no light at the end of this tunnel.
Right. And you mentioned getting vaccinations at birth. And my understanding, I think I heard you talk about this at one point, is why they're given at birth and at such a young age, because you have such an underdeveloped immune system until you're about 1 year old. So why would you actually need a vaccine when you're that young?
Well, I saw a doctor at a formal presentation several years ago say that children shouldn't be vaccinated at all until they're about 4 or 5 because of the development and maturation of the immune system. So there are different opinions out there about who should get how many vaccines and when, if any. And my position, my professional public position, is everybody should have the right to make that decision for themselves and their children in consultation with the healthcare professional of their choosing, whether it's allopathic or otherwise. Because as soon as you put that decision in the hands of the state where you're being required to, then the door is open for industry to influence to its benefit and to our detriment that decision, which is exactly what's going on in the world here. But the Hep B vaccines, when you say why are they doing it, it depends on what perspective. I mean, one answer to that question is because they can get away with it and make lots of money for it. You know, hepatitis B is not a high-risk disease for newborns. I can count on one hand the number of newborn children I've ever heard of anywhere who were sexually promiscuous intravenous drug users. You know, it's just a really small percentage. I think really, you know, right down there at or next to zero, I would guess. I'm being facetious here, but the point is to show you how stupid, it's incredibly stupid this is. And I remember somebody telling me they had asked a nurse once, well, why do we vaccinate newborns? And the answer was something like, because that's what we do. You know, that's the mentality that's out there with a lot of people. They just follow orders. You do what you're told. They don't want to make waves because they don't want to lose their job or be disciplined or be scolded or yelled at by, you know, the supervising doctor or whatever. So people are just all following orders. Well, that's what happened in Nazi Germany, okay? And you see the results there. So there's a huge profit there. But the medical reason that they give is, well, this was the only vaccine that at least some newborns would actually have an immune response to. They of course, have tried to give all the other vaccines at birth, but there's no immune response. So they wait till 2 months and 4 months and 6 months and 12 and 15 months and whatever it is they do with which vaccines. Supposedly, it's based on when they can get immune response in the infant or toddler or wherever it is. So that's the argument. But why, you know, that's why hepatitis B and no other vaccines. But why would you vaccinate for hepatitis B at all? The only risk is if a child's mother has hepatitis B, and you can test the mother ahead of time and find out. You don't need to risk injury or death from the vaccine by vaccinating every newborn just in case mom has hepatitis B. No, you test mom. And a vaccine's not going to help you anyway. This is the same story. You go into the emergency room with a deep cut or puncture wound and they want to give you a tetanus shot. It's not going to help you. If you're exposed to hepatitis B at birth, a hepatitis B vaccine is not going to help you. Vaccines take days or weeks to develop a full antibody response. And if you're exposed to tetanus by the cut, the tetanus vaccine isn't going to help you. What you need are tetanus antibodies. Maybe that would help you. But I'll tell you, when I talked about this with Dr. Mayor Eisenstein, he said, well, they used to do that, but they stopped doing that because they used to give the tetanus antibodies in the emergency room, but they stopped doing it because the reactions were so severe. So they said, well, we'll just give the vaccine. So it becomes, the whole thing is medically ridiculous. It serves a non-medical agenda, and most people are just going to follow orders and not question anything and not look into it for themselves. We got to get over that. The shift that is taking place, Tony, and that we need to facilitate with shows like this and other things that we can do, is a shift from external reliance to internal reliance, where we just turn over all the important decision maker to other people and just blindly follow whatever they say. Because whenever you do that, you open the door to manipulation and control. And that's exactly what's happened. Now, I'm not saying you don't look outside of yourself to get information, but at the end of the day, you take responsibility for deciding what's best for you and for your children, and we work to get laws in place that allow us to do that. Because while ultimately this is a scientific issue, are vaccines safe? Are they effective? Are they necessary? Are there other things we can do? That's all science questions. The way it plays out in our lives day to day is a legal question. At any given point in time, when somebody's required to get a vaccine, there's either a law that says you can say no or there isn't. So where the rubber meets the road primarily is in the state legislature. So we've got to become legislatively involved, whether we like that or not. And we've got to be proactive, pushing our agenda for informed choice, because whether we do that or not, they're pushing their agenda backed by huge sums of money and lobbyists and so forth. So if we don't become proactive, we lose. It's not a question of if, it's just a question of when. So that's where we need to get involved here.
Right, and you mentioned getting legislatively active, and I would point listeners to check out the National Vaccine Information Center, nvic.org, I believe it is, and go there, and you can get information about the states and what's happening in your own state, and also get on their list and get active so that you can get involved with what's happening locally in your own area in your state.
Yeah, I strongly recommend them. They have what they call their advocacy portal. They actually have a separate web address for that. You can get there from nvic.org, or you can go there directly from nvicadvocacy.org. And that's the advocacy portal. And they have really streamlined the process. You no longer have to take time off and make it a part-time job to be legislatively active. You can go to this website and sign up. And if you choose to join and give them your mailing address information, the software will tell you who your representatives are and what their phone numbers and addresses are. And they keep that information confidential, of course, so only they and the NSA have access to it. So it's a feeble attempt at humor there. Unfortunately, it's probably true. But the point is this. They've made it as easy as possible to be legislatively active and involved.
Excellent. Well, Alan Phillips, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony. It's been a pleasure.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You've been listening to Alan Phillips, interviewed by Tony Rango. Today's show has been Vaccines, Threads of Corruption. Alan Phillips is a practicing attorney headquartered in North Carolina. He is a nationally recognized legal expert on vaccine policy and law, whose practice is focused solely on vaccine exemptions and waivers and vaccine legislative activism. He advises individuals, families, attorneys, legislators, and legislative activists throughout the U.S. on vaccine exemption and waiver rights and vaccine politics and law. He hosts a weekly radio show, The Vaccine Agenda, every Monday evening, available at blogtalkradio.com/The Vaccine Agenda. He is the author of The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, published as an ebook. Visit his website at vaccinerights.com. He may be contacted at attorney@vaccinerights.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yarrow Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at G&B Radio.
Evolution of the mind. If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call to all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look what this side just tells. For peace, give thanks, live life, and release. You dig me?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Vice and Folly at Home and Abroad. We'll hear about Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and worse. We'll hear from William Bloom, David Rovics, Glenn Ford, and yours truly. I hope you'll stay tuned. As I speak, it is March 2016. You may have read in the press that the election carnival is well underway. What really strikes me, and not for the first time, is how right Noam Chomsky is most of the time when he talks about U.S. domestic and international affairs. Chomsky has repeatedly said that any dictator would be envious at how well the powers that be get the U.S. press to unanimously parrot the official line on every issue, regardless of the First Amendment, and despite the absence of government censors. How do they do it? I think of Chomsky every time I open up my daily newspaper. That's the former Manchester Journal-Enquirer, now the Journal-Enquirer of No Fixed Address. For months now, 90% of the paper's op-ed essays, and many of the editorials, and nearly all of the editorial cartoons, have been on this theme. Trump is no good. The Republican Party establishment must stop Trump. The American public must reject Trump. And every other newspaper I've looked at, including the New York Times, is doing the same thing. Now, I personally have no love for Donald Trump, and I have still less love for most of his Republican competitors, or for Hillary Clinton either, and I also have a serious disagreement or two with Bernie Sanders. So what I am saying is not partisan. I'm no fan of Trump. Still, I'm struck by the total unanimity of all published opinion here, and I'm struck by the total disdain for democracy that all the columnists are displaying. Not even lip service for democracy. Huge numbers of citizens are rallying behind a candidate that the establishment does not control, and the press is screaming for established power to do something to stop the will of the majority, or at least the will of the largest plurality, to stop it from being honored. Paul Krugman wrote a good analysis of the Republican side a couple weeks ago. Let me paraphrase. Trump is a scam artist, but all the establishment-approved Republican candidates are scam artists. For decades, government policies of both parties have consistently damaged white working-class citizens. Black and brown citizens, too, of course. But beginning with Nixon's Southern Strategy, so-called, the Republicans successfully pulled the angry working-class whites into their party, appealing to whatever racism, sexism, and homophobia these voters had, and also appealing to these voters' real, accurate fear of economic devastation and political powerlessness. The party then tossed the crowd a few bones. "We'll attack Planned Parenthood," say. Then they continued to implement policies that further impoverished the working class and further enriched the investor class. Well, you can fool some of the white working class some of the time, but you can't fool all of the white working class all of the time. and more of them have been catching on. All the so-called respectable establishment Republican candidates want to abolish Social Security and Medicare, make medical care even harder to afford. They want to cut taxes on the rich even more, privatize everything, and start even more wars against more countries. But Trump apparently is not taking these stands. Not all of them, anyway. Trump is running his own scams, but they're not the scams that the Fortune 500 want run. So, Trump must go. He's interfering with the success of the establishment's own scams. So says Paul Krugman. And, jumping in now myself, and so, democracy be damned, the press, which is the propaganda organ of the establishment, democracy be damned, the press is clamoring for the Republican elders to get rid of this loose cannon, Donald Trump. Anyway, here on our 2016 Vice and Folly show, we will hear from better minds than my own on Donald Trump, on Hillary Clinton, and other public figures. And we'll turn from ridiculous domestic policies to ridiculous foreign policies in a minute. One more domestic item first. It's not an important story, but it says something about the mood of the country. Here's an item from the AP, December 26, 2015. Western New York man legally changes name to Darth Vader. Canandaigua, New York. A man changed his name to match the villain in the Star Wars films. The former Eric Welch of Canandaigua, New York, says he grew up in a series of foster homes and didn't have any strong ties to his name. The Star Wars fan says he chose Darth Vader for his new name because the movie character carries an aura of leadership and toughness. Thus spoke the Associated Press. Well, Mr. Vader's lot in life is not a happy one. The story also says he is trying to raise money to pay for a bone marrow transplant. So I wish him well. Still, to connote leadership and toughness, Darth Vader? Could have been worse, I guess. Still, if you are seeking to rename yourself to connote leadership and toughness, what name would I recommend? Good one. How about Albus Dumbledore? How about Nat Turner? Maybe Howard Zinn? Well, we've been talking about democracy in action and the efforts by both political parties to prevent it. How about a song to celebrate it? A new song by David Rovix, They Couldn't Stand By. At the moment, United States foreign policy consists to a good extent of unprovoked war and war crimes. That was the case in other days, too, including the early 1970s. Then, we were pursuing a very large war against much of Southeast Asia, for no reason that made any sense, with no exit strategy, no possibility of winning, and at the cost of millions of innocent lives. On the plus side, it was good for business. The establishment and its mouthpiece, the press, were 100% firmly in support of this monstrous bloodshed. It was the average citizens of the United States, including many drafted soldiers and sailors, and some military officers, and millions of civilians. It was those guys who ended the war. The war ended when the American soldiers refused to fight it. The civilians refused to be drafted. Many refused to pay their war taxes. When millions took to the streets and refused to cooperate with the empire's evil criminal war. I was there. I remember. I remember the peace vigils, the marches, the draft card burnings. I remember the chants. 1, 2, 3, 4, we don't want your bleeping war. And also, hell no, we won't go. How about, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" Those were heady times, and scary ones, too. Incidentally, in 1968, the people were deceived by a Republican political scam artist, a con man who campaigned on ending the war, and then, when elected president, did everything he could to prolong the war. That was Richard Milhouse Nixon. He was the guy who began the strategy of luring every redneck into the Republican Party. Nixon himself was a racist and an anti-Semite, too. So, if you want to condemn Donald Trump's several moral failings, be my guest. But don't single him out alone. Anyway, it was the average citizen, including rednecks, along with hippie dips, Black Panthers, small business owners, workers with blue collars, workers with white collars, and ordinary suburban housewives. You name it. It was the 99% who brought the establishment's evil war to an end. America should be proud, at least of that. Here's David Rovix.
It's a story everyone should know. It happened half century ago all across this sprawling nation. The rising of a generation. It started slow and then gained speed. Nobody knew where it would lead. First there were marches, then there were more. Way too many to keep score. They shut down classes, couldn't learn. Once they ascertained how napalm burned, they had to find out how to defy. People stood up. Stand by. There were parades held by the military brass. There were cities filled with CS gas. Real wars, war games, recruitment centers up in flames. Light a match, then in a flash, draft cards turned to ash. Thousands moved across the border, refusing military orders. Every army base in the USA had an anti-war cafe. There are times when you just can't comply. People stood up because they couldn't stand by. Soldiers insisted on free will, put down their guns, refused to kill. Newspapers of the underground ubiquitously could be found across the country, across the sea, throughout the ranks of the military. Take a grenade, pull out the pin. Praise be to Ho Chi Minh. Another fragging every night. A war that many refused to fight. Bombs were falling. Some asked why. People stood up because they couldn't stand by. The ruling classes with all their powers shook inside their ivory towers. They were brought to their knees back then. That's why we don't have the draft again. Even back then, some of them knew they had to be careful what they tried to do. Rulers who miscalculate can lose control of their ship of state. In order to govern, you need consent. And all of that just up and went. In 68 came the reply. People stood up because they couldn't stand by. People stood up because they couldn't stand by. People stood up because they couldn't stand by.
So many of David Rovick's songs are little history lessons, and there's another. Let us widen our gaze from domestic policy disasters to foreign policy disasters. We'll have Glenn Ford speaking on our Syria policy in a few minutes. First, a nice essay by William Bloom. And before that, a really tiny little history lesson, courtesy of yours truly. Three countries in North Africa and the Middle East that had relatively progressive governments with good social welfare programs. Secular governments, not at all anti-U.S., countries whose people had a higher standard of living than the region's average. pretty good health care, pretty good education. Countries that had the best women's rights in the Arab world, and had governments that spent a good amount of the country's oil revenues and its other income on projects benefiting their citizens, such as health care and education. Countries that did everything they could to suppress extremist, radical Islamist terrorist groups. What were these three lights under the Arab world? They were Iraq under Saddam Hussein, Libya under Muammar Gaddafi, and Syria under Bashar al-Assad. Are you sensing any pattern here? Any pattern involving the U.S. foreign policy? And one of the creators of that pattern is named Hillary Rodham Clinton. Or so charges William Bloom in Counterpunch, March 11, 2016. I have edited and condensed his essay a little for radio. The title is American Exceptionalism and the Election Made in Hell, or Why I'd Vote for Trump Over Hillary, by William Bloom. Bloom writes, if I were forced to choose between Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, I would vote for Trump. My main concern is foreign policy. American foreign policy is the greatest threat to world peace, prosperity, and the environment. And when it comes to foreign policy, Hillary Clinton is an unholy disaster. From Iraq and Syria to Libya and Honduras, the world is a much worse place because of her. So much so that I'd call her a war criminal who should be prosecuted. And not much better can be expected from her on domestic issues either. Not from this woman who is paid $675,000 by Goldman Sachs, one of the most reactionary anti-social corporations in the world. She was paid for four speeches, and paid even more than that in political donations in recent years. Earlier, while her husband was governor of Arkansas, Hillary was on the board of directors of Walmart for 6 years. Could anyone expect to change corporate behavior by taking their money? The Los Angeles Times recently ran an editorial which began, Donald Trump is not fit to be president. The Times then declared, the reality is that Trump has no experience whatsoever in government. But for me, when it comes to politicians, experience means nothing. The only thing that counts is the person's ideology. Who would you sooner vote for? A person with 30 years in Congress whose political and social views are the opposite of yours? Or instead, someone who has never held public office but is an ideological comrade on every important issue? Clinton's 12 years in high government positions carries no weight with me. The Times continues about Trump. He has shamefully little knowledge of the issues facing the country and the world, quote unquote. But again, knowledge is trumped by ideology. As Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton had great access to knowledge. Clinton played a key role in the 2011 destruction of Libya's modern and secular welfare state, sending it crashing in utter chaos into a failed state. Until we overthrew him, Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi had been a leading foe of terrorists. With Gaddafi gone, Libya is now a haven for terrorists, from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. What good did Clinton's knowledge do? It was enough for her to know that Gaddafi's Libya would never be a properly obedient client state of Washington. Therefore, the United States, along with NATO, bombed the people of Libya almost daily for more than 6 months. They gave the excuse that Gaddafi was about to attack the Libyan city of Benghazi, and so the United States was thus saving the people of that city from a massacre. The American media, of course, parroted this story. Needless to say, no good evidence of the alleged impending massacre has ever been presented. Hillary Clinton championed the Western intervention in Libya. The New York Times credits her with convincing Obama to do it. The Times judged this, quote, her moment of greatest influence as Secretary of State, unquote. All the knowledge that she was privy to did not keep her from this disastrous mistake in Libya. And the same can be said about her support of regime change in Syria. Rather than supporting the Syrian government in its struggle against ISIS and other terrorist groups. Even more disastrous was the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, which she, as a senator, supported. Both policies were clear violations of international law and the U.N. Charter. Another foreign policy success of Mrs. Clinton is the coup ousting the moderately progressive Manuel Zelaya of Honduras in June 2009. This is a familiar story in Latin America. The downtrodden masses finally put into power a leader committed to reversing two centuries of oppression. And before long, the military overthrows the democratically elected government, while the United States, if not the mastermind behind the coup, does nothing to prevent it or to punish the coup regime. Clinton's State Department quickly resumed normal diplomatic relations with the new right-wing police state, and Honduras has since become a major impetus for the child migrants currently pouring into the United States. And on the domestic front, Hillary Clinton has been a reliable conservative. During the 2007 presidential primary, the conservative magazine National Review ran an editorial by the prominent right-winger Bruce Bartlett. Bartlett forecast that the Democrats would almost certainly win the White House in 2008. What to do? Support the most conservative Democrat. Bartlett wrote, "It is pretty clear that Hillary Clinton is the most conservative." During the same primary, America's leading magazine for the corporate wealthy, Fortune magazine, put Hillary Clinton on its cover. The cover headline read, "Business Loves Hillary." And Mr. Trump, he is much more a critic of U.S. foreign policy than Hillary or Bernie. He speaks of Russia and Vladimir Putin as positive forces and allies. He would be much less likely to go to war against Moscow than Clinton would. Trump declares that he would be even-handed when it comes to resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as opposed to Clinton's boundless support of Israel. Trump calls Iraq, quote, a complete disaster, unquote, condemning both George W. Bush and the neocons who surrounded him. Quote, they lied. They said there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and there were none. And they knew there were none. There were no weapons of mass destruction, says Donald Trump. Trump even questions the idea that, quote, Bush kept us safe, unquote, and adds that, whether you like Saddam or not, he used to kill terrorists. Yes, Trump is personally obnoxious. I'd have a very hard time being his friend. Who cares? Thus writes William Bloom in his very recent essay, American Exceptionalism and the Election Made in Hell, or Why I Vote for Trump Over Hillary. We have just enough time to hear Glenn Ford with an update on the U.S.'s war against Syria.
The five-year-long U.S.-led proxy war against Syria is about to spiral out of control with possibly fatal consequences for the human race. The Obama administration's web of lies, intrigue, and relentless aggression has turned Syria into the world's most insane field of battle, where both the United States and Russia provide air cover to Kurdish forces that are being shelled by America's NATO ally, Turkey. Turkey has also been shelling units of the Syrian army, operating under Russia's protection. With 18,000 Turkish soldiers poised at the border, a Turkish invasion of Syria is considered imminent and will likely include Saudi Arabian troops and aircraft, all of which would become targets for Russian air defense systems the second they violate Syrian land and airspace. Should Turkey and Russia come to blows, which is entirely possible within the next few days, the Turks could block the Bosphorus Straits, closing off access to and from the Black Sea, bottling up Russian naval forces and provoking a world war. The Turks temporarily blocked the door to the Black Sea back in September after they shot down a Russian plane. Meanwhile, Western governments, their royal Arab allies, and the global corporate media scream for some kind of so-called humanitarian intervention in northern Syria, a transparent call for the United States to activate its so-called Plan B, an all-out U.S. military offensive against who? The United States will claim it's against the Islamic State. These days, the U.S. claims everything it does in Syria and in Iraq is part of the fight against the Islamic State. But of course, there never was a U.S. war against the Islamic State, which spread like wildfire until the Russian Air Force intervened in late September. The U.S., the Brits, the French, Saudi Arabia, and the other Gulf kleptocracies financed and armed all of the jihadist gangs that descended on Syria after 2011. And although the Islamic State decided that it had plans of its own, the American coalition never tried to militarily defeat ISIS in Syria or Iraq. ISIS was still useful to wear down the Syrian army and keep the Iraqi government off balance and dependent on the United States. The success of the Russian intervention changed all that. Under Plan B, the United States and its allies will move militarily to absorb the Islamic State and take over the Syrian territory that the jihadists now occupy, de facto dismembering Syria. The surviving ISIS fighters would fight on under U.S. protection, distributed among other jihadist groups and under new political labels. At least, that appears to be the plan. However, the Turks have their own agenda. Turkish President Recep Erdogan has staked his political life on defeating and humiliating the Kurds in his own country and in Syria. But the United States has made a huge investment in acting as the protector of the Iraqi Kurds in order to dismember and control Iraq, and the Americans are trying to play the same game with the Syrian Kurds. That's why the U.S. is providing air cover to some Syrian Kurdish units, while the Turks are shelling other Kurds who operate under Russian air cover 60 miles away. The Turks don't like the game the Americans are playing and are threatening to invade Syria, confront the Russians, and force the U.S. to choose between Turkey or the Kurds or World War III. This is a very dangerous moment for the planet. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
With that, we end our show entitled Vice and Folly at Home and Abroad. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum, question authority, stand up if you can't stand by, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a close look at what was a very busy week in and around Syria, with the opening of real peace talks in Geneva and the surprise announcement on Monday of a pullback by Russia from active engagement in the fighting. President Vladimir Putin warned Thursday that Russia could ramp up its military presence in Syria within several hours if needed. He also urged all sides to the conflict to respect the current ceasefire. Putin made the comments at a ceremony in Moscow honoring Russia's war dead in Syria, at which he summarized the results of Moscow's five-month-long anti-terror campaign there.
Esteemed comrades, you remember how the situation in Syria was formed back in September 2015, and then a significant portion of the country was seized by the terrorist groupings, and the situation was degrading and worsening. In full accordance with international law, at the request of the legitimate government and the president of the country, a decision was taken to start a military operation. While we have immediately designated the objectives, the support of the lawful fight of the Syrian army against the terrorist groupings, and our actions have been recalculated on time, to prevent the attacks of the terrorists. And we had stated at the time that we're not going to get involved in the inter-Syrian conflict and looking for the final solutions to define the future of the country. That should be done by the Syrians themselves. So the main objective of our operation was to inflict a strike against terrorists. And fighting against international terrorism is fair and correct. It is a fight against the enemies of the civilization, those who bring along barbarians and violence, you know, trying to cancel the values of spiritual values that actually support this world. Let me state it again. Our main objective in Syria is to stop a global, terrible evil, to prevent it from spreading into Russia, so that our country have shown its indisputable leadership, will, and responsibility. So what results have we attained? Your actions, your strengthful combat operations have drastically changed the situation. We have prevented the terrorist cancer from spreading all over. We have destroyed the war depots of ammunition. We have blocked the routes of oil, smuggling oil, which was providing the main financial support to terrorists. We have conducted a lot of work in strengthening the lawful powers and authorities in Syria. And I have mentioned the same in the United Nations at the 70th anniversary session. We have helped to strengthen their armed forces, and currently they are not only capable of restraining the terrorists, but also conducting offensive operations. Yes, and the Syrian army have taken over the strategic initiative and is continuously cleaning up the land from terrorist gangs. And the main thing, we have created conditions for peaceful process there. We have managed to set up a constructive, positive coordination with the USA and a number of other countries, with those responsible opposition forces within Syria who actually want to stop the war and to find the only possible political solution of the conflict. So this path to peace, you have helped to open that. You did that, the soldiers of Russia. Dear comrades, after a NICAT had been reached for a ceasefire between the opposition and the government forces, the volume of operations for our air force have reduced significantly. The number of combat sorties have reduced from 60 or 70 a day to 20, 30 a day. So in this connection, the grouping of forces militarily have become superfluous. So the decision to take to withdraw the surplus equipment and personnel have been agreed and approved to the Syrian President Bashar Assad, and we have advanced him beforehand, and he had supported that. In the joint statement of the Russian Federation and the USA, it was stated that against the terrorist groupings, those acknowledged as such by the United Nations, the warfare against those will be continued, while against the military formation of the Syrian opposition, they have confirmed their readiness for a truce, for a ceasefire. There will be no actions against those. So let me draw your attention to the fact that if we will register the facts of breaking the truce from whatever groupings, they will be automatically excluded from the list that had been offered, had been provided by the U.S., with all the associated consequences for them. So let me designate now the objectives for our personnel staying in the Syrian Republic. Let me repeat, this will be a monitoring of the truce, providing the conditions for a political inter-Syrian dialogue, and our bases in Syria, Tartus and Khmeimim. The personnel on those bases will continue their service there, defending those bases in a reliable way from both air, sea and land. All of the components of the deployed air defense system, including the Panzer F short-range systems and the Triumph S-400 long-range system, will continue their active service. Let me note that to a significant degree, we have restored the potential of the Syrian air defense forces. All of the parties involved have been notified and are aware of all this. We are proceeding from the fundamental standards and regulations that nobody can offer, can violate the airspace of a sovereign country, Syria in this case. We have set up and we have an effectively working mechanism of preventing incidents in air with the Americans. While all the partners have been notified and they are aware of the fact that our air defense systems will be used against any targets that we will consider a threat to the Russian servicemen. Let me emphasize that again, any targets. And we will, of course, continue to provide support to the lawful government of Syria. That will be a complex support. It will be financial support, deliveries of equipment and material, contributing to training, organization, and good coordination of Syrian forces. This will be a reconnaissance and intelligence support, staff and headquarters support, and then also direct support. I will mean airspace grouping, strike, and support aviation air forces. The forces that are staying in Syria are sufficient to meet the existing objectives. We will continue providing support to the Syrian army and the authorities in their fight against the IS and Jabhat al-Nusra and other terrorist groupings that have been acknowledged as such by the UN Security Council. And our hard attitudes to terrorists had not changed. So whatever balance of forces will be there with a reduced Russian forces there, the balance will be provided for. Moreover, with our support and strengthening of the Syrian army, I am sure that in the near future we'll see new serious successes of the patriotic forces in their fight against terrorism. And as you may know, there are there's hard fighting going on around Palmyra at the near circle around Palmyra, and I hope that this pearl of the world civilization, or at least whatever will remain from it after the bandits have been there, have been active there, it will be returned to the Syrian people and the whole of the world. And if it will be required, Russia is capable of increasing its grouping in the region to the size that will be adequate to the situation in view, and we will use all the whole range of the capacities that we will have at our disposal. We would not like to do that because the military escalation is not our choice. So we are still counting on the common sense of all the parties, on the devotion of both the Syrian authorities and the opposition forces to the peaceful process. Let me note the position of the Syrian President Bashar Assad. We can see his reserve, his sincere wish to attain peace, and his readiness to compromise and dialogue. And the mere fact of withdrawal of a significant part of our grouping there, in view of the talks for the Syrian regulation, is a good positive signal, and I'm sure that all of the parties of the Syrian conflict will appreciate it properly. We will continue working and take all of the necessary measures in order to, in good cooperation with our partners, to contribute to the setting up of continued peace in Syria, so that we will rid the Syrian people that have suffered a lot from the terrorist threat, and will assist Syrians to restore their country. Esteemed comrades, you have proven that we have a strong, a modern, properly equipped army and the navy, good fighters that are capable of resolving large-scale and complex objectives. During this operation against terrorists, more than 9,000 combat sorties have been made. The Navy ships have inflicted massive strikes of the precision caliber missiles with a range of 1,500 kilometers from two seas, the Caspian Sea and the Mediterranean, both from the surface ships and from the submarines. So we are proud of professional actions of our sailors. The long-range aviation, strategic aviation, have contributed in a great way. The X-101 missiles have been, cruise missiles have been used properly with a range of over 4,000 kilometers. And in a short period of time, modern and effective system of air defense have been deployed in Syria, and coordination between all of the forces and means have been provided, as well as the logistic support have been provided. The transport aviation and the transport ships of the Navy have proven well as well. So all of the important issues of providing support at a remote combat theater have been provided in a proper, qualified way on time, which again demonstrates good capacities, increased capacities of our armed forces. Let me thank today the representatives of the military-industrial complex, the defense industries, both the designers, engineers, so that the modern weapons have been properly tested, not just at the test ranges, but at combat conditions, which is the hardest of all the tests and checks. So this experience will help us to provide necessary corrections so that the new generation weapons could be created, so that the armed forces could be perfected and their combat capabilities could be increased. So life has shown that this guarantees the secure way, the security of our country. We should remember all the threats that are there if we don't do anything on time. We should remember the histories, the lessons of history, including the tragic events of the Second World War, or the Great Patriotic War. What the miscalculations and military planning and preparation have led to, and the lack of modern equipment had led to at that time. So everything could be done in good time, while the weaknesses and the miscalculations are always dangerous. Of course, the military operations in Syria have led to certain expenses. But the main expenses have been the resources and the finances of the defense ministry. About 33 billion rubles have originally been provided into the budget of the defense ministry for the year 2015 for the combat training. So in other words, we have just retargeted those resources for the provision of our group of forces in Syria. And there's no other effective way of military training than the actual military action. Nobody has come up with anything else. So in this context, it is best to utilize and to expand the service life of the equipment in combat rather than on a test range. And you are the professionals. You are those who understand it best. Evidently, some additional expenses will be needed in order to replenish our arsenals to the levels needed, as well as the equipment levels, as well as current repairs and overhauls for the equipment that have been used in Syria. And I'm fully assured that those expenses are fully justified and they are needed, because it's only in the combat conditions. Many of the things that have been used could have been properly tested so that the faults could be discovered and eliminated. So those are the expenses for the strengthening the defense capacities, capabilities of our country in providing the current requirements of the defense for the Russian Federation. And all those things have to be done today so that in the future we will not have to pay a much higher price. And the price is not easy. It's not a simple price. And we're not talking about money. We have Elena Peshkova and Valentina Chermishina and Irina Kazinoch here and Irina Shuravlova, the widows of our comrades who have perished in their fight against terrorism. I understand that for the next of kin, the friends, the combat of comrades in arms of Ivan Alexander and those others, the loss of their lives cannot be compensated, and we all take that as personal loss. So I will. That's why I have listed them by names, not just as a commander-in-chief or a president, but as a grateful and a sad citizen of Russia. Our comrades have stayed loyal to the very end, loyal to their oath of allegiance and their military duties. We'll remember their courage and their nobility, and we'll remember they have been the real men and courageous fighters. Dear comrades, the military operation in Syria of large scale have taken 5.5 months, and that is a very difficult region far away from motherland. You have executed the military duty in a proper way, and you have defended the security of Russia and our citizens at the far limits and borders, the far reaches. So the objectives that have been set in front of you have been met. So the units are returning to their permanent bases back to Russia. Let me note in this hall, for this particular audience and for the rest of the country, the main agenda in Russia today is peaceful agenda. It is taking care of developing economy in the current complex conditions, in raising the welfare of our people. But without providing security, without building capable a modern army and the navy, we will not resolve those objectives and tasks. Moreover, without doing this, the existence of a modern, sovereign, independent Russia is not possible. And we are here today in the legendary Hall of St. George, commemorating the great glory and traditions of the Russian military, where the names of its courageous sons have been glorified. So we have here this spirit, victorious spirit of the Russian military. Our soldiers and officers have shown again that they are courageous people, noble people. They are strong by spirit. They are the fighters devoted to their fatherland. Let me thank you all for your service. I thank all of the participants of the military operation in Syria. Thank you so much.
For more insight on both what the thinking is inside the Kremlin and public sentiment within Russia, we spoke with longtime journalist and political commentator Dmitry Babich from Radio Sputnik via Skype Friday. Dmitry, welcome back. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
So, interesting summary, summation really by President Putin earlier today, at least bringing things up to date and making clear that there is a continuing presence by Russia inside of Syria and also a continuing role in the process going forward. You want to give us a quick summary of it?
Well, it's very clear that the Russian presence in Syria will be reduced, I mean the military presence. And I think the people who claimed in the beginning of the Russian operation, which started in September last year, that Putin is going to, to get bogged down in Syria, that it's going to be another Afghanistan, I think these people were basically wrong, and it is becoming apparent right now. Russia lost just three people, and that was only because of the rather treacherous action of the Turkish fighter jets, which shot down a Russian plane, a Russian military plane in the north of the country, and it fell on the Syrian territory. So I wouldn't even call it a casualty in the fight with terrorists or with the Syrian opposition. It was a casualty of a rather treacherous Turkish attack. So, in fact, this was a successful operation. And I think when the Western media, I mean, the mainstream Western media, when they say that it's a sign of Putin abandoning Assad or it's a sign of Putin giving up to pressure, you know, exerted by the United States and the EU economically, I'm not sure that this is true, because these people, they just never listen to what Putin has to say. They always read all kinds of evil intentions into Putin's speeches. And if you look at Putin's speeches in September last year, he made it very clear that Russia was not going to stay in Syria alone, that this operation of the Russian aviation would continue for the next 3 or 4 months, and then it would be replaced by other less large-scale operations. So I think these people should have listened to Putin, and that would have avoided them a lot of trouble about guessing his intentions now.
And, looking at where things are at as of today, Russia is going to maintain its updated somewhat base at Tartus for the naval base, and also has the air base in Latakia. If you think about them in terms of not just what happens in Syria next, but as strategic assets, as the U.S. is pushed up to Russia's borders, these are kind of at the rear of the front line of NATO in that part of the world. It's a useful asset there. Geopolitically, generally, what do you think has changed in the last 5 years that is, summed up with what's happened in Syria this past week?
Well, I think there are two different things. The last 5 years, I think, were a disaster in the relations between Russia and the West in general, and the United States in particular. And it was an avoidable disaster because there was no urgency for President Obama to bomb Libya or to get involved in the civil war in Syria. That was Obama's own decision and the decision of his so-called entourage, of his team. These decisions were absolutely disastrous. I would say that the decision to intervene in Ukraine, to intervene by the so-called NGOs and by political and financial support for the new Ukrainian regime, that decision was also catastrophic and very avoidable. Something that happened. And now Russia has to live with this new reality. So I think the foray into Syria was Russia's reaction to this new reality of a newly hostile NATO. I think it was important for Putin to show that the Russian military capability is with us, and that NATO will not be able to afford a real military confrontation with Russia. So that has been shown because the Russian warships fired their missiles against the terrorist targets in Syria from as far as the Caspian Sea. And let me remind you that Caspian Sea is the only water reservoir in the world where you don't have NATO ships, and where you potentially can't have them because this sea is basically divided between Russia, Iran, and several neutral states such as Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan. So there is very little chance that NATO would be able to deploy any warships there. So that was Putin's technical goal, and this goal has been achieved. His political goal was to show the limitations of the American power, to show that instead of fighting the Islamic State in a serious way. The United States was actually trying to topple the legitimate government in Syria. The so-called Western coalition had been bombing the so-called Islamic State for 11 months before the Russian planes got involved. And there was absolutely no effect. Now the difference in the position of the Islamic State between September 2015, when Russia started to bomb, and now, the difference is tremendous. The Kurdish units are making forays as far as Raqqa. You know, the territory controlled by the Islamic State is shrinking, and the leaders of the Islamic State are finding refuge as far as Libya. You know, the country which was supposed to be made democratic and safe by the people like McCain. So basically, I think it was a success on all sides. And Putin is not a global, you know, Putin is not into a global game against the United States. His strategy is not to change the world completely, not to be a global alternative to the United States and the Western world. I think his strategy is to defend Russia's national interest and to show other countries such as China and India and Brazil, how you can act independently of the so-called global West defending your interests. So this goal has been achieved in Syria, and Putin decided to limit the Russian involvement there before it becomes too dangerous. And also, I think Putin indeed wants to give a chance to Syria's peace process. He made it very clear in his statement in the beginning of the Russian operation last year, that Russia was not into regime change in Syria. Russia was not into making the government of Bashar al-Assad survive by all means. Russia was into helping Syrians to decide their own future without interference from the global Islamist organizations or from the Western countries.
Do you think in terms of popular support inside Russia, that the Syrian operation could be compared in relation to Russia's problem in Afghanistan with the United States' invasion of Grenada, not on moral grounds, but in terms of how that ended, quote-unquote, the anti-war sentiment in the United States, or the Vietnam syndrome, as they called it?
Well, I think the comparison with Afghanistan is definitely wrong. And in Russia, only the stupidest liberal media made that comparison. They wanted it to be like Afghanistan, but there was no chance this would be another Afghanistan, because in Syria, Russia had the support of the legitimate government, and there was a powerful ground force, which Russia only had to help from the air. So comparisons with Afghanistan are completely wrong. Comparison with Grenada is... Maybe only in terms of how the government media,
yes,
and the mainstream American media played it up. Because for Russian media, of course, the action in Syria was important because it showed that Russia had the military capability that allowed it, without any, almost any losses, to inflict great damage on the Islamists. So that was reflected in the media. I know that the Western media was very unhappy about it, but that was just one of those cases when it was important for Russians to know that we have a strong army again. This is the only parallel that I see with Grenada, because obviously Russia was not changing the regime in Syria, and the United States was changing the regime in Grenada. And certainly Russia was fighting a much more powerful enemy in Syria, that is the Islamic State and other terrorist organizations, whilst the U.S. government in Grenada fought just against a small group of people who wanted to shape the future of Grenada in a different way.
And finally, one interesting use that I heard the English translation, I wouldn't have the wherewithal to contextualize the Russian, original Russian, but the translated as a reference to the military-industrial complex of Russia, and saying that they had the opportunity, basically, to battle test a lot of the new weaponry and utilize it against terrorists, which seems to be like a twofer, really, because these terrorists he had already painted as they are a threat to Russia. They were being trained, uh-huh. many of them, for Russia. So in terms of that, what do you think of the idea, essentially, of Daesh operating as lab rats almost?
I don't think that the Russian leadership is cynical as to be happy to test weapons on living people, right. even if these living people are terrorists. I think that basically the main idea was to show the opponent, more and more aggressive opponent, that is NATO, that Russia has the weapons. And this is a kind of deterrent. Instead of trying to show how these weapons work, in Europe, it's much more safe to show these weapons in action against the terrorists in the Middle East.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mamie Rosenberg.
1948 was a watershed presidential election year. To place our present situation in historical perspective, later on we'll present a Labor Radio speech by then president of the Screen Actors Guild, Ronald Reagan, when he was a liberal supporting Harry Truman.
But first, after a resounding yes vote to unionize with the Culinary Workers Union, Local 226, Trump's Hotel Las Vegas, refused to recognize and bargain with the union as required by federal law. Now, boss Trump has filed objections to the outcome of a free and fair union representation election won by the workers who want a union. And recently, the National Labor Relations Board issued another federal complaint against Trump, alleging that his company unlawfully told one employee, "You're fired,"
and discriminated against another based on their union support. Federal officials maintain Trump's hotel company engaged in the numerous unlawful practices, such as issuing rules prohibiting workers from communicating with one another and the public, engaging in surveillance and interrogations and intimidating employees, and suspending and threatening to fire union supporters. If Donald Trump wants to make America great again, said Maria Jaramillo, a housekeeper at the Trump Las Vegas, he should start by negotiating a fair deal with us.
Trump's Las Vegas hotel workers say he's anti-worker. He'd rather say you're fired than allow workers to unionize. And we speak now with Bethany Kahn, Director of Communications of Culinary Workers Union Local 226, and a worker at the hotel, Luis Carlos. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Bethany Kahn, why don't you begin by telling us what's been happening at the Trump Las Vegas Hotel?
About a year ago, the workers of the hotel decided to organize. Since then, the hotel has run an anti-union campaign against their own employees. There's been a lot happening in terms of unfair labor practices and charges that the unions filed. But the thing that's new is that the workers voted in by a majority, won an election to be represented by the culinary union, and the hotel filed objections to that vote. Recently, the National Labor Relations Board recommended to be overruled entirely. That's a huge victory for workers and for the union. And so now we call upon Mr. Trump, who's a 50% owner of that hotel, to negotiate a contract with his employees immediately.
Bethany, if you could go a little bit more in detail about the unfair labor practices that Trump has engaged in, what were the complaints?
Well, an example is when the first day when the campaign went public, five workers went to work at the Trump Hotel Las Vegas wearing union buttons. they were unfairly suspended. The union filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board on behalf of the workers that the management was asking them about their union activity and telling them their union buttons were not part of their uniform. So that's an example of illegal activity. And so we filed those charges with the National Labor Relations Board. The next day, the workers were brought back to work with full back pay, like a whole day that was lost. So that's a victory for the workers and for the union, and we continue the fight every day to make sure there's a contract.
Let's take the story a step back. Tell us who the workers are and, indeed, what brought them together towards the end of wanting to unionize.
The Kelmer Union has been fighting for workers and their families for 80 years. So the Trump Hotel Las Vegas is a five-star boutique hotel just off the Strip, surrounded by hotels and casinos that are union. There's quite a bit of a standard in Las Vegas in terms of working people, having fair wages, job security, good health benefits. And on the Strip, workers are paid approximately $21 an hour, including benefits. So at the Trump Hotel Las Vegas, the workers are paid approximately $3.33 less per hour across all classifications, including they have to pay huge sums of money for health insurance, and they don't have a pension, so they can't retire with dignity. So these are workers who do housekeeping, bartenders, cocktails, food servers.
I think we have Luis on the line. Luis?
Yes?
Why don't you just dovetail with what Bethany was saying, and can you talk about your experiences at the hotel as a worker?
Wonderful. Well, my name is Luis Carlos. I'm working as a banquet server. I'm working for around 3 years. My Stephanie said about it, we get fight for almost a year and a half to get the contract. Finally, we get the election. And so now what we want is Mr. Trump sit down with us and sign the contract. We get less money and health care. We don't have any benefits. That was one of the main points to fight for this election and try to get the contract as soon as possible, because comparison with the rest of the hotel in the city, we are made $4 less than everybody. We don't have pension. Our health care is not the same like everybody, and that's what we're fighting for.
When you did start to unionize, when you did start to organize, what did you experience from management?
Well, it was very difficult because they don't want any union. They don't want us to be work together as a team, as a unionizing. Obviously, they promise better things for a lot of employers, and we don't want it. What we want is our union to represent us, to fight for us. For them, it was so difficult to understand why employees want to be a unionizer.
Luis, have you worked at unionized hotels? Is it better there?
Absolutely. I worked for 3 different hotels, and I see the difference. The difference is unbelievable. We make $4 less than everybody here in the city. We don't have pensions. Our health care is nothing comparison to what we get from the union.
And what about your job itself? What do you do there, and how is it the same or different than at other hotels?
I make $4 less than everybody in the city. Well, we do the same job. And when any guest coming to Tron International, we take care of them. We are not sure they have the best experience. And the same time, that's why we ask him, Mr. Trump, get for us what we want, because we give you 100%.
Luis, Trump is patting himself on the back, going out to blue-collar workers and saying that he's a great friend of the working class. Obviously, you don't think so. Why not?
He don't treat us like everybody in the city. We make less money. We don't have pension. We don't have health care benefits. This is not only for us. This is for our generation, to make America great. They do favors to the people close to them. Was not equal treat to everybody. Some people got better, some people don't. And that's what they're showing. There was not a union. There was not an equal opportunity for everybody. They prefer some people, and they give you better chips. They give you more hours, which for union and for us was not fair.
And Bethany, I wanted to ask you more particularly about the worker who was fired. I know there's a complaint with the NLRB around that. What exactly happened there?
I mean, there are several complaints of unfair labor practices. And so the five workers who were suspended unfairly, that's just an example. There are other charges that we have alleged, which include incidents of physical assault, verbal abuse, intimidation, and threats by management, including when the vote was taking place on the December of last year, that the union alleges in one of the complaints that management and, you know, other staff were trying to intimidate or coerce workers into voting no against the union.
And Bethany, the NLRB, of course, being the National Labor Relations Board, when you said that there were physical assaults and so on, can you flesh that out for us more?
There's a specific example that I'm not going to comment on further other than to say it was an example between security pushing a worker in a parking lot. And so the NLRB recently has issued a complaint calling for a hearing of charges, just like the one I explained to you, on April 12th. And so on April 12th, we'll have a hearing of all these charges that were brought, and we'll go from there. And we're confident that the National Labor Relations Board will rule in favor of the workers and the union, as it's done so in the past.
And Bethany, Trump has contracted with a number of anti-union firms, union-busting firms, the Labor Relations Institute and Cruz and Associates. What can you tell us about those firms?
And I assume you don't mean Mr. Cruz.
Yeah, not Cruz,
no. Different law.
Yes,
could be.
So there's a standard in Las Vegas that every employer has remained neutral on the Strip. MGM Resorts International, Caesars Entertainment, Mr. Wynn, Phil Ruffin, all the owners of the major properties on the Strip in downtown have remained neutral.
What does that mean?
When their workers, right, so they don't try to intimidate, harass, bully, or litigate, and let their employees choose whether to unionize or not. You know, it's just respecting the wishes of their workforce, and like workers they know what they want, and they've decided that they want a union representation, just staying neutral and not running an anti-union activity or campaign. And so that's what the Trump Hotel in Las Vegas has done, is hired Lupe Cruz Associates. They ran a several months long anti-union campaign, and you know, it's shameful that the hotel won't remain neutral and respect the wishes of their workers.
Bethany, how many workers are we speaking about? How many
people? It's a little over 500.
A little over 500
families that unionizing at the Trump Hotel represents. And now those workers, by a majority, 53%, voted to be represented by the Culinary Bartenders Union. And so now the next step is to negotiate a contract with Mr. Trump. The one thing I think is important to note is that Mr. Trump owns a hotel in Toronto, Trump Toronto. Those workers voted for the election, and they won a union. And a month later, Mr. Trump's company made a deal with them. So we are wondering why it's okay to have an agreement and a deal in Toronto, Canada, but not here in the United States of America. Both workers and both properties voted and won a contract. The Toronto workers got a contract. The workers here haven't.
Well, I'd like to ask you your thoughts on that. What is the politics of that?
I don't know. Mr. Trump says that he's a great negotiator, and that he wouldn't be afraid to negotiate with anyone. And so we would like him to sit down and negotiate a contract with his employees.
Do you think the Canadian labor laws are tougher than ours? Is that part of it?
You know, I don't know about that, but I do know is that we are very confident that in every step the company keep appealing and objecting, that the National Labor Relations Board will continue to rule in favor of the workers who won a fair and free election. And so it's just a matter of time before the company will be required legally to bargain with the union.
Where does it stand exactly right now? What's the next step? Because the overwhelming vote has been pro-union, not an easy thing to get. Hooray, success. And so what happens now?
So we call on Mr. Trump to sit down with the hotel employees, his employees, to begin negotiations. The hotel objected the hearing officer's recommendations, and so they're appealing that, and we're waiting on the National Labor Relations Board to come down with another ruling, but we think siding with us again. We'll just ask once again to start negotiating contracts.
And Lewis, I wanted to ask you, what kind of a boss, if you were telling other workers throughout the country, what kind of a boss is Mr. Trump?
Well, the problem is we don't see Mr. Trump in Vegas, so management is the one do everything over here. And we already won the election, but they don't own it yet, the election. And that's where our employees and my co-workers have bothered us, because we already won. What they're waiting for? We need to sit down with him as soon as possible, because, like I say, we're losing money, we're losing benefits, We don't have a pension. Every single day is a struggle for us, not only for us, but our family. In this battle, this was to get better education, not only for us, for our family, for previous generations. And Mr. Trump forgot about this great country. They are made for immigrants. Don't forget about it. They are made for immigrants.
And what happens to the worker who was fired? What happens to the worker who was, or workers that were assaulted? Are all of these things included under the National Labor Relations Board complaints? And what kind of relief do they get?
And so even though there isn't a contract implemented at that property, the union is still able, under with the help of the NLRB, to protect workers. We've gotten workers back to work. We've gotten them their back pay that they were owed. And so there's a way for us to fight for the workers and to make sure that workers are get what they deserve and have justice. But, you know, that's an example of a union contract. If there was a contract in place, there'd be a grievance process and procedure. There would be rules that would be, you know, talked about beforehand. So we do what we can, but we're very successful. We continue to win these cases.
Just remind us of how important it is for workers like Luis, for any workers to be able to unionize and to have a collective bargaining agreement. How important is that? Because certainly that's a feature that was left out of Mr. Trump's rallies when he talks about making America great. I thought it was the working class that made America great.
Yes, and here in Las Vegas, we believe so. You know, we're proud that for 80 years, the Culinary Union has represented over 735,000 workers. These are workers who have good jobs with job security, good health benefits, and fair wages. And they, Culinary Union members, comprise the majority of the middle class in Nevada. So around the country, as the middle class is shrinking, here in Nevada, we've been able to protect and preserve. And workers have good jobs. They can afford to send their kids to college, buy their homes, and keep those homes during a recession. These are all the really important things so that workers can have a strong middle-class opportunity here in Las Vegas. And that's really what workers want. They want the opportunity to provide for their families. And a union contract means that.
Yes, Mr. Trump really doesn't know how to make a deal or doesn't want to.
Oh, my gosh, the art of the deal, huh?
Yep.
Well, I guess he doesn't, but I know that our friends from the Culinary Workers Union are on the case. We hope to get that ruling. When do you think we might get the NLRB ruling?
We don't know when the ruling on the unionization is going to come down, but we expect hearing from the National Labor Relations Board to take place on April 12th. Regarding some of the unfair labor practice charges that the union brought to the NLRB.
And Luis Carlos, are you going to continue to organize for your family, for yourself, for your coworkers?
Absolutely. This rallies and this battle is not only for this contract and all like that. This is for future generations. This is the battle that our kids have to see and learn that you have to be fight for your rights. And this is important for that, not only for this moment, but for the future generation to understand not what the people say we cannot do it. We can do it. And that's where the union is strong. And we are totally happy with our union because they 100% and they fight for us. And in the difficult moments and the happy moments, they are with us every single time. And I want to tell you, thank you for the time. And I want to thank you to give you the opportunity. And hopefully our generation and our families, we got better and better because this country will be great no matter what.
Luis Carlos, si se puede, for sure. I know this is going to happen with people like yourselves, and you're absolutely right. It's for this generation of workers and their children. And thank you for all of your commitment to provide support, wages, benefits, grievance procedures, and all else that we get when we collectivize our energies, when we unionize. So again, Luis Carlos, banquet food server at Trump Hotel Las Vegas, and Bethany Kahn with the Culinary Workers. For all that you do, si se puede.
Thank you. Union, union,
union. Union, union, union. Yeah. Gracias
thank
por
you.
Todos.
Right. Thank you. De nada.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
people all around me, and they're all unfair. They don't seem to want me, but they won't admit I must be some kind of creature up here having fits. From my parting house, I'm afraid to come outside. Although I'm filled with love, I'm afraid they'll hurt my pride. So I play the part I feel they want of me, and I pull the shade so I don't see them seeing me. Having hard times in this crazy town. Having hard times, there's no love to be found. Having hard times in this crazy town. Having hard times, there's no love to be found. I feel like needing others. Familiar faces creep, race a brother. But to my surprise, I find a man corrupt. Although he be my brother, he wants to hold me up. Having a hard time.
Oh, Mr. Dewey.
Yes?
Dear Mr. Hooey.
Hooey, not so
hard. Do you think the 80th Congress did their best? There's inflation here today.
That's
there's
true.
No housing on the way.
No, there isn't.
Is there any remedy that you suggest?
Oh, Mr. Voter, nice Mr. Voter, as my buddy Taft appropriately said, when the price is in excess, people really should eat less.
Then they won't need any houses.
No, they'll all be dead instead.
You know, Ken, I'm reminded of the election of 1948.
Mimi, wasn't that the year that Thomas Dewey was the Republican candidate and Harry Truman the Democratic Party candidate?
And Henry Wallace ran as the Progressive Party candidate, and Strom Thurmond ran as the candidate for the States' Rights Party. The Republican Dewey was soaring in the polls, and the Democrats were attacking the Republican Congress. And then, to everyone's surprise, Truman won.
Mimi, the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union had a radio show in 1948. On the show, it boasted of the virtues of Harry Truman and attacked the Republican candidate Thomas Dewey. And guess who the program starred? The great communicator himself, a man who in later years changed sides to himself become president, but in 1948 was a liberal Democrat and president of the Screen Actors Guild.
Ronald Reagan?
Yeah, would you like to hear part of that ILGWU broadcast?
Absolutely.
This is the story of what the Republican 80th Congress and the National Association of Manufacturers have done to bring on inflation and set back the cause of liberal government in the United States. Presented by the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union, now to Ronald Reagan in Hollywood.
This is Ronald Reagan. You know me as a motion picture actor. But tonight I'm just a citizen, concerned about the national election next month, and more than a little impatient with those promises the Republicans made before they got control of Congress a couple of years ago. I remember listening to the radio on election night in 1946. Joseph Martin, the Republican Speaker of the House, said very solemnly, "We Republicans intend to work for a real increase in income for everybody by encouraging more production and lower prices without impairing wages or working conditions." But what actually happened? The profits of corporations have doubled, while workers' wages have increased by only one quarter. Profits have gone up four times as much as wages. And the small increase workers did receive was more than eaten up by rising prices. For example, here's an Associated Press dispatch I read the other day about Smith L. Carpenter, a craftsman in Union Springs, New York. Mr. Carpenter retired some years ago, thinking he had enough money saved up so that he could live out his last years without having to worry. But he didn't figure on this Republican inflation, which ate up all his savings. And so he's gone back to work. The reason this is news is Mr. Carpenter is 91 years old. Now, take as a contrast the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, which reported a net profit of $210 million after taxes for the first half of 1948, an increase of 70% in 1 year. In other words, high prices have not been caused by higher wages, but by bigger and bigger profits. The Republican promises sounded pretty good in 1946. But what has happened since then, since the 80th Congress took over? Prices have climbed to the highest level in history. Although the death of the OPA was supposed to bring prices down through the natural process of free competition. Labor has been handcuffed by the vicious Taft-Hartley law. Social Security benefits have been snatched away from almost 1 million workers by the Gearhart bill. Fair employment practices, which had worked so well during wartime, have been abandoned. Veterans' pleas for low-cost homes have been ignored, and many people are still living in made-over chicken coops and garages. Tax reduction bills have been passed to benefit the higher income brackets alone. The average worker saved only $1.73 a week. In the false name of economy, millions of children have been deprived of milk once provided through the federal school lunch program. This was the payoff of the Republicans' promises, and this is why we must have new faces in the Congress of the United States. Democratic faces. This is why we must elect President Truman for adequate low-cost housing, for civil rights, for prices people can afford to pay, and for a labor movement freed of the Taft-Hartley law.
Now let's hear historian Eric Fauna put the past in perspective.
What did you think of the speech, and why do you think, why are you going to vote for that man you just heard?
I would certainly support him for any office in the land. This was 1948. He's talking about issues of social class that are no longer part of our political dialogue today. The notion that the conditions of workers are actually worth considering by politicians. In the 48 election, there were four parties, the Democrats and Republicans, of course, Dewey for the Republicans and Truman running for re-election as a Democrat. You had Henry Wallace on the left as the Progressive Party candidate, who was pushing even more strongly on these economic issues as well as civil rights and opposing the Cold War. And on the right, you had Strom Thurmond from South Carolina and the States' Rights Party, which was formed after the civil rights issue was raised strongly at the Democratic National Convention, and the Democratic Party in 48, for the first time since Reconstruction, made civil rights of blacks a major political issue, prompting a walkout of several southern states and the formation of the States' Rights Party. So Truman and Dewey, each of them was flanked by what appeared at the time to be pretty strong alternative parties. The 48 election was the first post-war election. It also, as Reagan's speech indicates, came after the Republicans had won control of Congress in 1946 and had gone on to pass the Taft-Hartley Act and many other very conservative measures. Many observers thought that the congressional election of 46 was a harbinger of Republican victory in 48. Truman led a very vigorous campaign against the Congress and against the Republicans and really reinvigorated the New Deal coalition by playing on workers' fears that the country might slip back into a depression, that the Republicans were simply draining off income from the working class in order to benefit profits and the well-to-do. Truman succeeded in tying Dewey to the very right-wing Republican Congress and in reinvigorating this New Deal coalition. He also, for the first time, made civil rights a big issue in the campaign, recognizing the growing significance of the black vote in the North. Blacks could not vote in the South at this time, but because of World War II, there had been a significant migration of blacks into the northern and western states where they could vote, and the black vote was becoming very crucial. So Truman ran a very, very intelligent and vigorous campaign. Dewey ran as if he was absolutely assured of election. The Wallace campaign was, of course, a tremendous disappointment to those further on the left who had really hoped that this was the opportunity for a permanent third party to be created. Wallace pushed much more strongly than Truman on civil rights. Indeed, he campaigned in the South for black rights, which took a certain amount of courage at this time, and pulled Truman toward that position in order to maintain his hold on the black vote. But the big issue between Truman and Wallace was foreign policy, and Wallace was strongly opposed to the Cold War, the Truman Doctrine of containment of communism all over the world, and the endless involvement of the United States in suppressing revolutionary movements all over the world. As the election drew near, much of Wallace's support evaporated as many of the more left-wing voters began to fear Dewey's election and felt that a vote for Wallace would be wasted. So it was a very historic election. It maintained the grip of New Deal policies on the presidency. It also secured the dominance in the Democratic Party of what you might call the Cold War liberals, those who were liberal on domestic policy but very powerfully anti-communist and pro-Cold War in international affairs. Soon after the election, the flurry for civil rights was dropped by these liberals. So in terms of race, the 48 election was a harbinger of things to come, but the 50s were not a time when either party really did much on the race issue until the mass movement of blacks really began.
Oh, Mr. Dewey.
You've been listening to selections from a 1948 election year radio program featuring Arnold Stang and Ronald Reagan. Commentary was provided by Professor Eric Fona.
This has been a Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report special report, filed by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
I represent the working men.
Do you promise, Mr. Dewey?
Promise? Oh, I'll promise anything. I want to be the president.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
It may be hard to remember how difficult it was for people to talk about HIV/AIDS back in the 1980s.
I'm not quite sure where Secretary Clinton got her information. I'm glad she apologized.
I got some good news to tell you.
What?
I've been keeping a secret about me and Chester.
Woo! I know what it is!
I had come from almost nothing and then got this role in this movie, and my life has just did a total 360.
This is something she's always wanted to do, and I'm so proud of her.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. India's archaic sodomy law withstands another repeal effort. Hillary faces scorn for her Reagan praise, and Tangerine's tiny camera tracks telling trans tales. Those stories and more this week, because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Carol Myers.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending March 12, 2016. Lawmakers in India refused on March 11th to consider repealing the antiquated anti-gay sex law the nation inherited from its former British colonizers in 1860. It's the second time in the past 3 months the politicians have voted to keep infamous Penal Code Section 377 in force, which criminalizes carnal intercourse against the order of nature and punishes consensual adult gay sex with up to 10 years in prison. It was ruled unconstitutional by the Delhi High Court in 2009, but unexpectedly reinstated by the Supreme Court in 2013. A private member's bill offered once again by National Congress MP Shashi Tharoor to repeal the statute was rejected by a vote of 58-14 this week, with one abstention. His first effort in December 2015 was defeated by a vote of 71-24. Shashi wrote on Twitter that it was another bitter disappointment. Several MPs who promised to vote in favor were absent. Despite activists' best efforts, members of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party have consistently opposed reform. Tharoor has called it a simple case of religious bigotry. The Supreme Court's 2013 ruling said that only lawmakers could repeal the statute. But the High Court agreed earlier this year to hear what's called a curative petition to reverse that ruling. While there's no specific timetable, its deliberations could be the last chance for judicial repeal of India's odious Section 377.
The escalating war on LGBT people in Indonesia has prompted rights groups to set up safe houses and hotlines for sexual minorities. Fearing anti-queer violence, they're suggesting that gay people delete LGBT-friendly websites and cut social media ties with anyone who might disapprove of them. It all began in January when Indonesia's higher education minister proposed banning out LGBT students from the nation's college campuses because they violate the nation's morals. The defense minister has since warned that the LGBT rights movement was intent on brainwashing Indonesians into acceptance. The Indonesia Psychiatric Association declared last month that LGBT people are mentally ill. The country's broadcasting regulator has banned TV and radio programming that portrays sexual minorities as normal to protect children who are susceptible to duplicating deviant LGBT behaviors. Dedi Otomo, founder of Gay Na Santara, the country's leading LGBT rights group, told the Reuters news service this week that the unprecedented legislative and theological assault on LGBT rights by government officials and leading Muslim clerics even has some activists making plans on how to flee the country if things get much worse. "My guys don't even go to the office anymore. It's too dangerous," he said. "We've never really experienced this."
A pro-LGBT YouTube video that the Kenyan government has tried to ban, without much success, is reportedly now more popular than ever. Official attacks on a remix of the Macklemore and Ryan Lewis hit Same Love by Kenyan rappers Art Attack, which argues for a sex rights movement in other homophobic African countries as well, has already prompted an actor who appeared in the video to flee the country, and police officials are reportedly looking for members of the rap group for possible prosecution. "We expected that this will create controversy," a member of Art Attack told Reuters, "but we didn't expect the amount of publicity it has received." The remix features two shirtless men under the sheets in bed and a lesbian couple kissing on a park bench, but there's no sex and no nudity. Nevertheless, the Kenya Films Classification Board's Ezekiel Mutua told a news conference that the video is obscene. The board ordered Google, YouTube's parent company, to ensure that the video can't be seen inside Kenya, but the tech giant has thus far refused to comply. The board also threatened to ban Netflix more generally earlier this year for content that undermines the nation's moral values and national security. Private, consensual, adult, same-gender sex is punishable in Kenya by up to 14 years in prison.
Refugees fleeing homophobic countries became controversial at this year's 38th Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras Parade. A video by one of the organizers of the No Pride in Detention float shows parade organizer Anthony Russell threatening to yank it from the procession if any of the participants harass or say something to Australian opposition Labour Party leader Bill Shorten, who personally led a Rainbow Labour contingent in the parade. No Pride in Detention organizers accused both Shorten's Labour and the ruling Liberals of illegally imprisoning LGBT refugees offshore on Nauru and Manus Island in Papua New Guinea, where same-gender sex is illegal. Their protest demonstration at the end of a Mardi Gras pre-parade news conference featuring Shorten apparently prompted the warning. The situation was diffused after members of No Pride in Detention, which was scheduled in the parade immediately after Rainbow Labour, suggested that the two be separated by several other entries among the 178 floats and some 12,500 participants. Ruling Liberal Party Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull joined an estimated 500,000 spectators and glad-handed many of them, but didn't march in the parade itself. Nonetheless, it was the first time the federal leader of one of the two major parties has marched in the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras parade, and the first time a sitting prime minister has attended the festivities.
In other news, the U.S. Supreme Court on March 7th reversed the Alabama State Supreme Court's refusal to recognize co-parent adoptions by same-gender couples. An unnamed lesbian filed the appeal after Alabama's highest court refused to recognize her adoption of the three children she helped raise with her former partner. After the women separated, the birth mother denied her former partner visitation rights. The ex-partner then established temporary residency in Georgia, and a court there granted her adoption rights to the three children. Alabama's high court dismissed the Georgia ruling, however, saying it had no jurisdiction there, effectively denying the ex-partner any rights as a parent. But the Supreme Court overturned the Alabama decision because it had failed to honor the full faith and credit provisions of the U.S. Constitution, writing that a state may not disregard the judgment of a sister state because it disagrees with the reasoning underlying the judgment or deems it to be wrong on the merits. According to BuzzFeed, the U.S. High Court decision was unanimous.
But a federal judge in Puerto Rico ruled this week that the June 2015 Supreme Court marriage equality ruling doesn't extend to U.S. territories. District Court Judge Juan Perez Jimenez ruled on March 8 that Puerto Rico's marriage ban was still in force because the Commonwealth is an unincorporated territory and not the functional equivalent of a state. Perez Jimenez ruled against marriage equality in Puerto Rico in 2014 and was overruled. The island's governor, Alejandro Garcia Padilla, quickly told reporters that, I'm going to respect the rulings of the higher courts, which thankfully ordered matters to proceed much differently than Judge Perez Jimenez. And the advocacy group Lambda Legal says it plans to challenge the ruling. Staff attorney Omar Gonzalez-Pagan said in a statement that the U.S. Supreme Court has indisputably held that the constitutional guarantees of liberty and equality apply with equal force to the Commonwealth.
After a record-breaking Democratic filibuster of more than 39 hours, the Missouri State Senate's dominant Republican majority voted 23-7 on March 10th to protect people opposed to marriage equality from state sanctions. Senate Joint Resolution 39 establishes a constitutional amendment that prohibits the state from penalizing clergy, religious organizations, individuals, and certain business people who act on their religious beliefs against civil marriages between two people of the same gender. The measure now goes to the House, which has a 2-1 Republican majority. Because it's a proposed constitutional amendment, the bill does not require the approval of Missouri Governor Jay Nixon, who's a Democrat. He joined major businesses in the state this week that have included Dow Chemical and Monsanto, along with the St. Louis Chamber of Commerce, to oppose the proposal as discriminatory. Nixon said in a statement this week that the bill would be contrary to our values and be harmful to our economy. If it passes in the House, voters would be asked to approve the constitutional amendment at the ballot box.
And finally, officials in Stockton have canceled the Central California City's annual Easter sunrise service rather than face the possibility of celebrating with LGBT worshipers. The event organizer, Stockton Police Chaplain Jim Reed, rescinded an invitation to the Reverend Terry Miller after he found out that she leads the LGBT welcoming Valley Ministries, telling her that, "We are diametrically different in our view of Scripture when it comes to homosexuality." Reed was soon placed on leave by the Stockton Police Department and later fired. After the head of the Stockton Leadership Foundation reinvited Miller and her wife, the organization, where Reed remains a board member, unexpectedly canceled the event. A news release said there was concern that the Easter service's transforming message will be overshadowed as a result of the well-publicized clergy invitations. Miller said she was very sad that the decision had been made to cancel the 17th annual event. She told the Stockton Record newspaper that, "These folks, who claim to be Christians, are squandering this opportunity because of some perceived differences instead of uniting under the banner of what this day is supposed to mean."
That's News Wrap for the week ending March 12, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
You'll hear about a first-of-its-kind independent film and a first-of-her-kind transgender actress later in the program.
We met at 9.
We met at 8.
I was on time.
No, you were late.
Ah, yes? I remember it well.
Memories were selective as dozens of dignitaries gathered to lay former U.S. First Lady Nancy Reagan to rest on March 11th. Former First Lady and current Democratic candidate for president Hillary Clinton shared some revisionist recollections about her predecessor with MSNBC that brought down an avalanche of criticism from the LGBT community.
It may be hard to remember how difficult it was for people to talk about HIV/AIDS back in the 1980s. And because of both President and Mrs. Reagan, in particular Mrs. Reagan, we started a national conversation when before nobody would talk about it, nobody wanted to do anything about it. And, you know, that too is something that I really appreciate with her very effective, low-key advocacy, but it penetrated the public conscience and people began to say, hey, we have to do something about this too.
Guess you just had to have been there. Queer press and social media exploded with responses to Clinton's gaffe from those who remember well how President Reagan notoriously remained silent about AIDS during the first years of the epidemic, and how Mrs. Reagan even rebuffed a personal request for federal action from her friend Rock Hudson. Hudson and some 40,000 other U.S. citizens died while the Reagans were in the White House. Senator Bernie Sanders reacted to the controversy surrounding his rival for the Democratic nomination in an interview with CNN.
I just don't know what she was talking about. In fact, that was a very tragic moment in modern American history. There were many, many people who were dying of AIDS. And in fact, there was demand all over this country for President Reagan to start talking about this terrible tragedy. And yet he refused to talk about it while the AIDS epidemic was sweeping this country. So I'm not quite sure where Secretary Clinton got her information. I'm glad she apologized. But the truth is, it was not President Reagan and Nancy Reagan who were leaders in talking about this issue. Quite the contrary. They refused to allow that discussion to take place. They didn't get involved in it while so many fellow Americans were getting sick and dying.
Clinton's initial reply that she had just misspoken fell flat, and the uproar continued. She then issued a lengthy apology statement featuring a list of policy proposals that she'd initiate as president to address HIV and AIDS. That received high marks from her critics. Sanders later responded with his own AIDS policy statement. Clinton never attempted to explain how a lifelong progressive was simply unaware of how the AIDS crisis unfolded while she was serving as First Lady of Arkansas.
It warms my heart to know that you remember still the way you do.
Ah, yes. I remember it well.
Well, folks, we'll be back in a minute with more excitement right after this word.
I'm Kate Clinton, and while I can joke about the political state of our country, it's no laughing matter what Congress could do to our civil rights.
Hi, I'm Cleve Jones, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
An informed community is a strong community.
History was made at the Film Industry's Independent Spirit Awards on February 27th. We'll hear from the director of Tangerine later, but first, the envelope opens for his winning cast member.
And the Spirit Award for Best Supporting Female goes to Maya Taylor.
This is Maya Taylor's first film role, and this is the first major film award ever given to a transgender actress.
First of all, no one tells you how nervous you're going to be when you're up against, like, other big actors for an award. You know, there's so many things that go through your head. You know, am I going to trip on this long-ass dress getting up here? You know, am I going to plant my face in the ground? There's so much. So, I have had a long journey through my 2015 because I had come from almost nothing. And then got this role in this movie, and my life has just did a total 360. I'm so out of breath. I feel fat. But I met this wonderful director and writer, Sean Baker and Chris Pagosh. Sean Baker and Chris Pagosh said, "We're going to film this movie on iPhones." Yeah. The first thing I thought is, this movie ain't gonna be shit. But it turned out to be amazing. And, you know, I started meeting this amazing team with Darren and Shiting, our producers, Mark and Jay Duplass, Marcus and Carrie Cox, my co-stars, Kasana Kiki Rodriguez, James Ransone, Mickey O'Hagan, and the worst one of them all, my manager, Alan Mindell, which I love. I love him. I love him. I love him. He gets on my nerves, but I love him. I love him. Yeah. Joanne Wiles,
Magnolia, who did our distribution. I love you, Ariane Rocky. She makes my life so much easier. My mother and my partner, James, I love you. You're my everything. And most of all, thank God, you know? So what I want to leave with you guys today is there is transgender talent. There's very beautiful transgender talent. So you better get out there and put it in your next movie. Thank you guys so much. I love you all.
Backstage at the Indies, Maya Taylor elaborated on her personal victory.
Almost 2 years ago, I had applied for 186 jobs in 1 month and did 26 interviews. The reason why I couldn't get a job was because my name and gender wasn't changed. You know, even though I look like a girl, then go inside of an employment agency or whatever, and then it says something else on my ID, I couldn't get a job. And, you know, it was very depressing and everything, but I pushed and pushed and pushed. And then when this opportunity came, it was an opportunity given from God, and I took it. And, you know, I guess, like, it made up for all the struggles that I had went through. So keep pushing.
Independent Spirit Best Supporting Actress Maya Taylor's opportunity came in the form of an unusual movie co-written and directed by Sean Baker. He chatted with entertainment correspondent Steve Pride about bringing Tangerine to the screen.
It grabs you from the first frame. Gritty and groundbreaking, Rolling Stone. Uproarious, a must-see, the New York Times. Even those who don't count themselves among the transgender prostitute movie shot on an iPhone demographic will want to try Tangerine, Daily Variety.
My name is Sean Baker. I'm the co-writer and director of a film called Tangerine, about two transgender sex workers who frequent the area of Santa Monica and Highland, which is an intersection that borders West Hollywood and Hollywood in Los Angeles, California, and it takes place on Christmas Eve. Cinderella finds out from her best friend, Alexandra, that her boyfriend has been cheating on her while she's been away in jail for the last month.
I got some good news to tell you.
What?
I've been keeping a secret about me and Chester.
Girl. Woo! I know what it is! Oh, you're breaking up with him. Thank God. Because, what? Honey, for him to be cheating on you like that...
Wait, what?
She decides at that point to track down the cisgender woman who is a part of the affair and confront her.
All men cheat. That's why they're called trade. Do them just as dirty as they do us. Out here, it is all about our hustle, and that's it. What are you plotting?
What is this based on?
Well, my co-screenwriter, Chris Bragash, and I were both cisgender white guys from outside of that world. And so when we decided to make this film, we had no idea what the plot or script would be. And we decided to meet people from this area, immerse ourselves. And this stemmed from just the multiple stories and anecdotes that we heard. One of our actresses, Kitana Kiki Rodriguez, told us that in the past, recently, her boyfriend had cheated on her with a cisgender woman. And so we took that and ran with it. We thought it was a sad but universally themed story of infidelity. And then we thought this could be quite a layered story and take our characters on a journey. That's where the A plot comes from. The B plot and all the other details really came from what we observed, what we heard, and really the feedback that we got from women in the area who told us how they wanted to be represented on screen and what stories they wanted to be told on screen.
So you found the actresses first?
Yeah. These are the sort of movies I make that are usually about worlds I'm not a part of. So what happens is that I have to spend a tremendous amount of time in the research process. But what I do is that I blend stages of filmmaking. So while I'm looking for the script, I'm also keeping my eyes open for possible lead actors. And in this case, we found Maya. Maya introduced us to Kiki. And immediately when I saw the two together, I thought, okay, well, now we're going to have to write a screenplay with two lead characters for these two women to play.
Where did you find Maya?
Chris and I initially hit the streets, just introducing ourselves to people on the streets, and we weren't getting very far because we were looked at as either police or tricks ourselves. And so we couldn't really find anybody to share that enthusiasm with us and want to be a part of this project. And then we expanded our search and we went over to this LGBT center, which is a block away from Santa Monica and Highland. And there's a courtyard there. And we saw Maya sitting there with some friends. And the first thing I thought was, that's the one. We have to speak with her. Her physicality drew us in, but also her aura. She was commanding the conversation that she was a part of at that moment. And she had a strong personality even from 30 feet away. So we approached her. She said, I'm an aspiring entertainer. Here's my information. Next thing you know, we're hanging out regularly and conversing.
What was her background?
She came from Houston, Texas. She came to Los Angeles before her transition. And she's an aspiring entertainer, focusing mostly on singing. So when I told her about this project, she, of course, wanted to participate, but she said, will I be able to sing in the project? And that's basically why we wrote that scene in which she sings at the club. She's found it very difficult to live in Los Angeles in those years after coming here because, as you know, it's very difficult for trans people to find employment. And she happens to be a trans woman of color who came from poverty, so the opportunities weren't there for her. And it was a struggle for a long time. And that LGBT center that services youth at risk was very helpful for her, finding her housing, etc. So really, she was in a limbo when we met her. She didn't know what she was going to be doing next. And we met her at a time where she was unsure about her future. I mean, this is something she's always wanted to do, and I'm so proud of her.
What did you learn from doing this film?
Of course, I learned about the sisterhood within the trans community. But again, this is a very specific trans community. I like to use the word community in the plural sense because there are trans communities, there are trans movements. This just happens to be one very small microcosm of one. So within that area, I learned a lot about what trans women of color coming from poverty have to deal with on a daily basis. Part of the reasons that actually led them to the streets. They're not there because they want to be in no way, shape, or form. They're there because oppression and discrimination have actually given them no other option but to resort to this underground economy, which is either, you know, sex work or selling drugs. I also did learn, though, that we all cope with our everyday existence and the pressures and problems with life with humor. I think that's how humans get by on a daily basis. We use humor to get by. These women who are dealing with even more hardship than the rest of us, they have to use their humor to even a greater degree to cope. And that's something that I saw from day one, hanging out with Maya, hanging out with Kiki and their friends. For me, it was quite a pleasurable time because I was always laughing. They were making me laugh. They were incredibly witty, incredibly funny, using their humor to get by, making jokes about the predicament that they were in. And then at night, I would get home and I would think about everything and I would think about the sad state of affairs that their existence is a part of. And it struck me as something that was like during the day I was laughing and at night I was crying. And I wanted to infuse that into the movie. I wanted to actually have that balance of emotion and of tone in the film because that's how I was feeling on a daily basis while doing this research.
This has been a conversation with filmmaker Sean Baker. Tangerine is available on DVD, Blu-ray, digital download, and is currently streaming on Netflix. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones, Carol Myers, Kate Clinton and Cleve Jones, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Some of the music you heard came from the Gigi and Tangerine motion picture soundtracks, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our special From Outlaws to In-Laws compilation CD, and even more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WREK Atlanta, Georgia, KUCR Riverside, California, 2XX Canberra, Australian Capital Territory, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned, you hear?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Against the grain. As the migrant crisis in Europe continues to grab headlines, who's talking about who's investigating the situation in Lebanon, where almost one in four people are refugees from Syria? I'm CS. I'll talk with two members of a delegation that traveled to Beirut, Lebanon in January, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. By one account, half of Syria's population has been displaced by the conflict there, the civil war. Many of the displaced have made their way to Europe, raising anxieties among people and politicians. But while the hand-wringing, official bickering, and in some cases wall-building continue, a crisis of monumental proportions continues to unfold in Lebanon, a country of only 4.5 million people that has taken in, despite limited space and resources, that has taken in more than 1 million refugees from war-torn Syria. Today, we focus on the badly underpublicized situation of Syrian refugees in Lebanon, how they live, what they do to survive, and the obstacles they face both administratively and in everyday life. And since more than half of all Syrian refugees in Lebanon are children, we'll examine how the young people are doing at school and in the workplace when, as is too often the case, their parents rely on them for income. In January, the International Refugee Assistance Project and the UC Berkeley School of Law sent a delegation of six students to Beirut, Lebanon, where they met with Syrian refugees and visited schools and the offices of an LGBT advocacy group. Hassan Ahmed and Tori Porel were part of that delegation. Hassan is a Canadian lawyer and Masters of Law student at Berkeley Law. He's lived and studied in Syria, and he's been back to the Middle East several times. Tori Porel, a first-year Berkeley Law student, has lived, studied Arabic, and worked as a human rights observer in Syria, Palestine, Jordan, and Egypt. Hassan and Tori are both case coordinators with the International Refugee Assistance Project, which provides legal representation to refugees seeking resettlement. And IRAP's Berkeley Law Chapter issued a report about what the delegation learned about the refugee situation in Lebanon. When Tori Porel and Hassan Ahmed join me in our Berkeley studios, I began by asking Tori how easy it was, in the first years of the Syrian conflict, for people fleeing Syria to enter and reside in Lebanon.
Initially, Lebanon was extremely welcoming to Syrian refugees. There's been a long history of ties between the two countries, and it was very routine before the conflict for people to pass back and forth regularly. And once the conflict began, refugees were able to pass still back and forth very easily. They didn't even need passports in many cases. They could pass with just their ID. Once they entered Lebanon, unlike other neighboring countries such as Turkey or Jordan, they weren't confined to refugee camps. They were free to move about the country within Lebanon and seek employment or stay with families. And they were also free, importantly, to travel back to Syria to conduct business, to sell property, to seek medical treatment, to check on family members. And this was very important in maintaining the stability of the situation for the first few years.
The issues obviously started afterwards, after the Syrian civil war. Basically, it just grew, and where you had the numbers rising of Syrian refugees coming into neighboring countries, that's when the added constrictions took place, the added documentation needed, the need for sponsorship. But initially, Jordan, Turkey, and Lebanon were fairly open in allowing Syrian refugees in.
So do we know when Lebanon's policies toward allowing people to enter, when they changed? And it sounds like we kind of talked about the why, which is increasing pressure on institutions and resources within these countries. But let's talk about Lebanon.
So there were de facto changes that took place in the summer of 2014, but they were codified in January of 2015, where you went from minimal documentation needed for Syrian refugees coming to Lebanon, where they would get UNHCR certificates. So the UNHCR is the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. And this certificate was renewable every 6 months. But what happened after January 2015, in large part due to the influx of refugees coming into Lebanon, was the implementation of residency permits and also the requirements for having a Lebanese sponsor for all Syrian refugees. Now, obviously, there's certain problems that arise out of that, including exploitation, whether in employment or living circumstances from Lebanese sponsors. So in sum, the requirements for Syrian refugees coming to Lebanon became a lot stricter after January 2015, when these changes took place.
So just concretely, let's say a Syrian after January 2015 is trying to enter Lebanon. So what exactly would happen? What would the border guards or the authorities at the border tell you? And could they just simply exclude you from the country?
Yeah, one of the main problems was that the new laws passed in January 2015 did contain humanitarian exceptions that would have allowed Syrians fleeing from violence to enter the country. However, these exceptions were not being implemented at the border at the time. The instructions given to border officials had been that these sweeping new changes were in effect, and they were excluding people who legally probably should have been allowed into the country, and many people became trapped in Syria.
So another aspect of this as well is essentially the contravention of international law. So in international refugee law, there's a concept which is called non-refoulement, which means that if you have a refugee that shows up at your borders claiming to have a well-founded fear of persecution, saying that my government is persecuting me, I had to flee, legally a country is not allowed to turn them away. So what happened in January 2015 with requiring this additional documentation and also the requirement for a Lebanese sponsor, it was essentially inhibiting Syrians who are fleeing their country to come into the borders of Lebanon. So there's an implicit contradiction of established international law.
So you mentioned, Hassan, you mentioned residency permits. Are they different than the certification or the registration you might need to get from the immigration agency or from the UNHCR to establish yourself as a refugee, to have that status?
So yes, so these are two different concepts. The requirement for a residency permit as opposed to the UNHCR certificate, which was the sole requirement prior to January 2015. So the residency permit, one, it costs $200 every 6 months to renew, whereas the UNHCR certificate came at no cost. One difference between the certificate and the permit is that under the UNHCR certificate, Syrian refugees were not allowed to work within Lebanon, and there would be pretty frequent checks by the Lebanese authorities to ensure that Syrians were not working. But under the new provisions where you require a permit, $200 every 6 months, that's a lot of money for a Syrian who had to flee everything, who is not working, who does, and they're barely able to afford food and shelter, let alone pay $200 to renew their permit.
What hoops do you have to go through to get a certification as a refugee in Lebanon?
With the UNHCR certificate, to be determined to be a refugee, you have to prove that you have a credible fear of persecution in your home country. And this is ascertained through a series of interviews where refugees are often forced to relive some of the most traumatic moments of their lives, often many times in a row, to different strangers.
Now, if you get the certification, you can't work. What's up with that? I mean, how is someone supposed to support themselves?
That's a very good question, because cash supports from the UN have been slashed dramatically for refugees. Food vouchers from the World Program have been slashed to, I think, $13 a month per person, which is nowhere near enough to buy food in Lebanon, much less pay rent or these kinds of things. This system of not allowing refugees to work legally has forced most refugees into working illegally. And this just opens them up to all kinds of exploitation. We met with refugees who are regularly paid half or less of what their Lebanese counterparts are paid for doing the same work. Sometimes bosses just withhold wages entirely, and not providing legal channels for refugees to support themselves have resulted in 90% of Syrian refugees now living below the poverty line in Lebanon.
Now, in what ways does the requirement for a sponsor increase the risk to the safety and health of a refugee?
Well, the requirement for a sponsor essentially makes you at the beck and call, if you're a Syrian refugee, to the sponsor that you have, where you can be exploited. You're basically reliant on that person for your shelter, for your food, and basically for your existence within the country. And what it does, it doesn't provide independent citizenship for Syrians or any path to citizenship, essentially. So they're in this kind of ambiguous state permanently, where they've had to flee their homeland, but they don't have any permanent status within Lebanon as well. So you have this stateless population. And in addition to that, as they spend more time there and as there's children born in Lebanon from Syrian refugees, they're also put into this stateless predicament.
That's Hassan Ahmed. He is a Canadian lawyer and a Master's of Law student at the UC Berkeley School of Law. Also joining us in studio is Tori Porrell. She's a first-year law student at Berkeley Law, and they were part of a 6-student delegation that traveled to Beirut, Lebanon in January to meet with Syrian refugees and also to visit schools and advocacy groups. And out of that trip in January came a report that describes the experiences of Syrian refugees in Lebanon and what they face in terms of employment, shelter, health care, education, and the like. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. If you don't get the certification from the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, then you are undocumented, I believe. And so what percentage of Syrian refugees in Lebanon are undocumented? Do we know that?
90% of Syrian refugees in Lebanon are now undocumented. This puts refugees at risk for being harassed by Lebanese security officials. They can be given deportation orders. And while deportation orders against Syrian refugees are not currently being carried out for illegal presence solely, if that refugee were to be charged with another criminal offense, they would be deportable back to Syria.
And so I assume if you're undocumented, you also don't have access to the services that might be available to someone who is certified, who does have documents.
So, for instance, if we take access to health care, there were subsidies from the UNHCR providing, in the case of emergencies, up to 75% of health care that would be covered. Now, if you're an undocumented refugee, you don't have access to something like that, in addition to food vouchers. If you're undocumented, you don't have access to food vouchers. So the basic necessities of life are not available for undocumented refugees. Now, what happens is that you have a black market that begins to form, where Syrian refugees have to find alternative means to meet their basic necessities of life when they're not documented.
And if you are certified or registered as a refugee and you can't work, as you said before, what can the authorities, the Lebanese government or its affiliated agencies, do to confirm whether or not you're working for purposes of getting all the benefits that you theoretically deserve?
We heard from refugees about trying to renew their status with their UN certificate. And the ways that the officials would try to test if they weren't working is they would make random visits to the refugees' home at all hours. They would call them many times in a row or several times a day at different hours. And if at any of these check-ins the refugee wasn't at home or didn't answer their phone, the authorities would presume that they were working illegally and their refugee status would automatically be revoked.
The refugee camp phenomenon. So you said that Syrians are not put in refugee camps when they cross into Lebanon. Is that a positive thing, that refugees are not forced to enter and reside in camps?
So initially, when you had smaller numbers of Syrians coming into Lebanon, it was considered to be positive vis-a-vis the Palestinian population in Lebanon that are within refugee camps there. Now, as the populations increase and the resources haven't, you have increasing poverty among Syrians. And what this has resulted in, essentially, is homelessness across all parts of Beirut. And so in that light, having UN refugee camps provides a benefit, where there is a piece of land where Syrian refugees can find a home. So initially, what was considered to be an added freedom for Syrian refugees not having to live within camps has now actually become a problem.
Tori, there were lots of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon before the Syrian crisis began in 2011 and the flow of Syrians to Lebanon began. How would you compare how the Syrians are treated versus how the Palestinians have been treated in Lebanon? And what is your sense of whether the Lebanese authorities learned something from the Palestinian refugee situation that they might have applied now to the Syrian refugees?
The Palestinian refugee situation in Lebanon has been going on since the late 1960s, early 1970s. And initially, the Lebanese government built quite a few refugee camps for those fleeing from Palestine. And what I think the main lesson the Lebanese government took from that was, if you build it, they will stay, which doesn't really pan out in reality, because it's not as if the Palestinian refugees have had a state that they could return to at any point since the 1970s. So when this latest Syrian crisis came about, Lebanese officials were very wary from the Palestinian experience in Lebanon and felt like they wanted to create conditions that wouldn't entice Syrian refugees to want to stay in Lebanon.
So what do we know about the tendency of refugees in Lebanon to go into debt?
Debt has become an increasingly terrible problem for Syrian refugees because, as we've mentioned previously, Syrian refugees can't work legally. They're forced to do illegal work to survive. Yet the wages they're being paid for the illegal work really don't even cover their basic necessities. And this has caused, I think, most families, up to 70% of refugee families, into debt from either local grocery stores, from Lebanese business people, from other family members, from complete strangers. And just the amount of debt is growing for them the longer they stay in Lebanon, with no options to ever seemingly pay it back. We encountered one man who was in this exact situation, whose young son had developed leukemia. and he managed to get enough money to pay for the boy's treatment, but had to take out quite a few loans. And so he was working illegally for a Lebanese business, and he told us that when he told his employer that his son had cancer, that it would increase his wages. But what he found was that his employer actually paid him less because they knew he was desperate for the work. And sure enough, he just had to keep working for the same employer, and he's just been taking on more and more debt to save his son's life.
To what extent are parents turning to their children to help sustain the family?
Well, for both documented and undocumented refugees, when you get a minimum amount of food vouchers, of health care. So the UN food vouchers, there's a maximum of 5 vouchers per month, which equal about $108. Now, $108 is not going to last you very long. So because of that, especially if you're on the UNHCR certificate and you can't work, many families have resorted to having their children work on the black market. Now, obviously, this increases exploitation as well. And in addition to that, you have children who should be in school who need to work to support their families, and therefore they can't get their right to an education as well. So you have many Syrian children who are out of school, who are doing everything they can in addition to their parents, simply to meet their basic needs and to pay their basic expenses of food, shelter, and health care.
Yeah, we met one mother during the interviews that we conducted who told us that her son, who was around 14 years old, was at the top of his class back in Syria, that he loved math and science, and he couldn't wait to go on to become a doctor or an engineer. And she showed us a picture of him now carrying rocks around because they can't afford to put him in school, and they can't afford for him not to be working.
And what about healthcare? So I think one of you mentioned that UNHCR will cover something like 75% of the cost of at least certain medical procedures. To what extent is that satisfactory in terms of helping Syrian refugees with healthcare costs?
The arrangement through UNHCR is kind of bare minimum. It's not sufficient to cover all of refugee healthcare needs. The UNHCR program only covers emergency treatment. For example, we met a family whose child had their appendix burst and needed emergency surgery. And in that case, they were able to go to certain hospitals who are affiliated with UNHCR, and UNHCR is able to cover 75% of that cost. Now, the problem with this is that it leaves the refugees to shoulder 25% of the cost, which is still extremely significant when we consider that 70% or more of them are living below the poverty line and have very few means of support to themselves. What has also started to happen in Lebanon is that hospitals know about this UNHCR policy and tend to jack up rates for Syrian refugees in order to get more money from UNHCR, but this also forces higher costs onto Syrian refugees.
That voice belongs to Tori Porel. She's a law student at UC Berkeley School of Law. Hassan Ahmed also joins me. He is a Master's of Law student at Berkeley Law, and the two of them work with the International Refugee Assistance Project, which sent, along with Berkeley Law School, 6 students to Beirut, Lebanon in January to meet with Syrian refugees from the Syrian conflict who now reside in Lebanon. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Tori and Hassan. Please stay with us.
Thank you.
And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. On our website, againstthegrain.org, you'll find a link to a report issued by the International Refugee Assistance Project and written by six Berkeley law students who went to Lebanon in January to meet with Syrian refugees and also visit schools. We'll hear about that in a moment, and advocacy groups, as well as the, as I understand it, the Beirut-based staff of the International Catholic Migration Commission, which handles the applications of refugees referred for resettlement to the U.S. And my two guests in studio are Tori Porell. She's a first-year law student at UC Berkeley School of Law, and Hassan Ahmed, a Master's of Law student there. Yeah, so one of the things you folks did was to visit two schools in Beirut to see what was happening in terms of the education of Syrian refugee youth in Lebanon. And before we talk about specifically those two schools, what has the Lebanese government done on the, say, the public education front to respond to the influx of Syrian children who, I'm reading from the report, constitute more than half of all Syrian refugees in Lebanon?
So the Lebanese government had increased the number of spots for Syrian refugees coming into Lebanese schools. So you would have primary education. There have been some issues, though, with undocumented Syrian refugees not being able to register within Lebanese schools. So those children haven't been able to get an education. And because of that, you do have NGOs that set up schools now as well. But in terms of the Lebanese government's response, initially it was to accommodate for the growing numbers of Syrians coming to their shores and the larger amount of students that they would have to accommodate.
And public schools in Lebanon are free. So does that mean that cost poses no obstacle to the parents of Syrian children who go to the public schools?
Despite being tuition free, there are a lot of associated costs with sending children to school in Lebanon, particularly for refugee families who are doing the best they can to survive on next to nothing. For example, many families can't afford to send their children to school in terms of transportation costs. There are also supply costs that many families just aren't able to shoulder, uniforms, books, things like that. And also, as we've talked about, most Syrian families are undocumented now in Lebanon, and a lot of families fear that by sending their children to school, this will kind of bring them to the attention of the Lebanese authorities, and it can mean bad things for their legal status.
And I'm going to guess that private schools are costly and kind of not reachable by most in terms of the finances of most Syrian refugees.
Exactly. So most Syrian refugees cannot afford the basic necessities of life, let alone sending their children to private schools. With that said, there are families, and this is a misconception that some people have about the refugee crisis, is that everybody that is leaving Syria is essentially poor, which isn't necessarily the case, because, and this puts a more nuanced and more complete story together when it comes to the refugee crisis, that you have middle-class Syrians that, because of the war, are no longer safe there. So they had to flee to Lebanon with whatever money they had or whatever resources they had, but they did come from a middle-class status. So, for instance, one of the families that I interviewed, despite the fact that they weren't able to afford a very specific surgery for their son, they were able to send their three children to private schools. But those are the vast minority of all Syrian refugees in Lebanon.
Let's talk about one of the schools you visited. It's called Yela School. It's providing specific services to refugee children. Tell us about what you observed.
So Yela is a school that's in an area just outside of Beirut called Alay, and it was started by an NGO in order to kind of bridge the gap for Syrian children, hopefully before they're able to enter Lebanese public schools. So as this crisis has drug on for 4 years now, many of these children have been out of school for some time. And for a primary age child, that can be really devastating in terms of setting them back in their educational progress. So what Yella aims to do is enrich these children and kind of get them up to speed in the core areas that they'll need to succeed in public school. So Arabic, English, math, and science. And the teachers are almost exclusively volunteers who volunteer to come in and teach these children. And their real aim is for their children to outgrow the school and find a place in the Lebanese public school system.
And then the other school that you visited, called Jassour, this operates three schools in Beirut, as I understand. Tell us about your visit to that school and what you observed.
So I had the opportunity to visit one of the Jassour campuses, which houses approximately 300 Syrian refugee children. They have three schools across Beirut, and the largest one, which is a 10th school, has almost 700 Syrian children. Jassour literally means bridges in Arabic, and it started as a nonprofit organization which provided scholarships for Syrians actually living outside of Syria. But after the conflict hit, they refocused their efforts and built these schools within Beirut. For me personally, this was one of the more touching and emotional experiences, because a lot of the interviews we did, they're based on our perspective as lawyers and looking at the black letter law and understanding whether a refugee family is eligible for resettlement. But when we went to these schools, we had the opportunity to sit and chat with these children, with the teachers, and really get a sense of what their experience was fleeing their homeland. The teachers that I talked to said that it's very difficult to educate refugee children initially, because a lot of the work that is being done for at least the first 6 months after they first enroll in these schools is simply trauma management. These are children who range anywhere from 4 or 5 years old to 12 or 13 years old, and they have seen people murdered on the street, they've seen beheadings, they've seen vast amounts of violence that we have no equivalent of in our society. So there's a lot of trauma there from these children. Now, in terms of the school itself of Jassour, the teachers there are volunteers. Most of them are not trained as teachers. And the resources that these schools have are so minimal. So they're trying to teach basic English. They're trying to teach basic Arabic. Now, one of the differences between the Lebanese and the Syrian school system is that the Lebanese system is taught in English, whereas in Syria, everything is taught in Arabic. So you have these children who have little knowledge of English, and they're coming into the Lebanese school system now, and they're just learning the basics. And on top of that, they have their life circumstances where they had to flee Syria, where they're acclimating to a new climate. They're learning a new culture, essentially. So there's all these things going on there, and there's been so much uncertainty and sadness and trauma in these children's lives. And the point of these schools is just to provide some normalcy again and to provide some stability.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We were talking today about the Syrian refugee crisis in Lebanon. More than a million refugees live in Lebanon. They make up about a quarter of the entire population of Lebanon. And while we hear about Turkey and about European efforts to try to get Turkey to stop sending or allowing refugees to travel by boat to Europe, while we hear about the migrant crisis in Europe, we hear a lot less about what's happening in a country like Lebanon, a neighbor of Syria that has accepted so many Syrian refugees, and the strain on institutions and resources in Lebanon is absolutely enormous. My two guests are Hassan Ahmed, whose voice you just heard. He is a Master's of Law student at UC Berkeley School of Law. He's a Canadian lawyer. And Tori Porel, she's a first-year law student at Berkeley Law, and they are both case coordinators with IRAP, the International Refugee Assistance Project, and they both went in January to Beirut, Lebanon, to look to observe firsthand what's going on with Syrian refugees in that nation. So what did you learn when you visited these schools about how the children felt about being in school and how much they valued the experience?
A lot of the children we encountered in the schools were so grateful to have a place to go during the day and really saw school as a refuge from the realities of their daily lives. A lot of these children come from families who are living in informal settlements or in apartments where they share with many other families and are cramped conditions, and their parents are worrying about money and they might be worrying about their legal status. But when they come to school, it's kind of their place to get away from all of that and just be children. One of the great things about the two NGO schools that we visited are that all of the students are Syrian. So it's not as if when these children might be in Lebanese public schools, they might be discriminated against or bullied because of their situation. But when they're at these schools, they're around children who really understand what they've been through. And these children, a lot of them came from all over different places within Syria, yet they have this common experience of having to flee their home and come to a new one.
Now, some Syrian refugees in Lebanon identify as LGBT. How are LGBT people treated under Lebanese law? Let's begin there.
Homosexuality in general in Lebanon is not considered illegal per se. So Lebanon has what's called the 534 law. It's a Lebanese penal law that makes sexual acts, and the quote is that it says, sexual acts that contradict the laws of nature. So it doesn't per se criminalize homosexuality or any aspects of being an LGBTQ person. But what we see both for Lebanese and for the Syrians that come as refugees is the social stigma and the de facto discrimination that takes place if you are LGBTQ. So we had the opportunity to visit Helam, which is a nonprofit organization working in Beirut that provides services for both Lebanese and non-Lebanese individuals who are LGBTQ, who have been discriminated against. So they provide social services, they provide advocacy support in order to support these people. And Helam is a fairly new organization still. It's still growing. And one of the issues with the LGBTQ community amongst the Syrian refugees in Lebanon is many people who might be from that community aren't explicit in that. So they're not able to fully realize their identity. They fear persecution. Already they're discriminated against because they're not Lebanese. Some of them might be undocumented. They might be concerned that they'll be returned back to Syria if their illegal status is found out. But on top of that, they're concerned that if it's known that they're gay or lesbian, they might be punished, or there might be violent attacks against them as well. While there have been some efforts from the legal community to advocate for that community, there's still a lot of work to be done. Even judges who have rendered decisions in favor of the LGBTQ community have been either reprimanded, or there's been a social stigma around them as well. We learned of one judge who ruled that sexual relations between a transgendered individual and another man was not considered to be prohibited under the 534 law. And what ended up happening was that that judge didn't get a similar case on his docket after that. So there are these legal and non-legal barriers that exist currently that make life very difficult for LGBTQ members of the Syrian refugee community, in addition to the regular issues they face just being refugees in Lebanon.
How much queer advocacy takes place online?
A large part of the LGBT advocacy in the Middle East has kind of moved online because of state repression. We met with one IRAP client who goes by the name of Adnan, who's fled from Iraq. He's a gay man, and when ISIS, who had been occupying his hometown, found out, they threatened to kill him, members of his family. So consequently, he's wound up in Lebanon. But what he told us was that he's been able to survive in Lebanon because of the support network of other LGBT individuals that he's found online. He's also started a blog where he promotes his story and supports different LGBT individuals from around the globe, and it's been a real source of support for him.
How do LGBTQ identified refugees, how do they fare in terms of finding housing in Lebanon?
Housing can be one of the main challenges for LGBT individuals and refugees. The organization we met with, Helem, talked about how a main part of their work with Syrian refugees who are LGBTQ is simply accompanying them to either meetings with aid agencies or landlords and just trying to advocate for them and see that they don't have their rights violated. We've heard horrible examples of the treatment of LGBT refugees by different aid agencies.
We've talked about the growing official resistance to Syrian refugees as the numbers of refugees in Lebanon have swelled. And, you know, I'm sure it's based somewhat on the alarm of officials in terms of how are we going to take care of these people? How are we going to accommodate these people? What about the local population, local institutions, and their willingness and ability over time to help this growing refugee population?
I think the Lebanese people have been extremely open and welcoming to Syrian refugees. We've seen official resources stretch thin, but heard countless stories of individual Lebanese families offering to take in refugees, provide employment. While the population may be somewhat, their patience may be somewhat wearing thin for this incredible number of refugees, they've been overwhelmingly tolerant, kind, and generous.
I think we need to remember as well that there's obvious criticisms that can be made of the Lebanese government, of the Lebanese population for discrimination that has occurred against Syrian refugees. But I also think we need to remember Lebanon is a country of only 4 million people. It's a very small country, both in population and geographically. And the fact that right now it has taken in over 1 million Syrian refugees, in addition to the Palestinian refugees that already live there.
Which is about 500,000, I understand.
So you have 500,000 Palestinian refugees in addition to the 1 million now Syrian refugees that have come within Lebanese borders. This places a great strain on the resources of a country that's already thin on resources. So we do have to remember the immense generosity of the Lebanese government, of the Lebanese people. If we look in proportion, the fact that over 25% of the Lebanese population consists of refugees, I don't think we can say that about any other country in the world. So while there continues to be issues, while there continues to be discrepancies in how Syrian refugees are treated both legally and non-legally within Lebanon, I think we have to understand that this was a country that opened up its borders with really no requirements initially for Syrian refugees, understanding that these are people that are fleeing a civil war. Lebanon also has its own history of a civil war, so that's very fresh in the people's minds, and they understand the results of war and what that does to ordinary people, and it forces them to flee from their homes. So Lebanon in that regard has been very generous. But with that said, there are continuing limitations, and we'd like to see full rights given to all Syrian refugees in Lebanon.
It's astonishing that only 1% of refugees in Lebanon are allowed to resettle in a third nation. Which refugees are the best candidates for resettlement? I mean, which are the most likely to be resettled in another country?
So actually, 1% of refugees are ever referred for resettlement, and the number that actually succeed in resettling to a third country is even smaller. So what we found in our work as refugee advocates is that it's really the worst of the worst cases who end up being referred for resettlement to a third country. This includes survivors of torture, women who are unaccompanied, and survivors of domestic abuse, unaccompanied children, families who have children with really severe medical needs that can only be treated in a third country, or those who have really pressing security concerns, either they are facing pressure from armed groups, or as we spoke about with LGBT refugees, discrimination and insecurity because of their identity.
Tori Porel and Hassan Ahmed joins me in our Berkeley studios. She is a first-year law student at the UC Berkeley School of Law. She has lived, studied Arabic, and worked as a human rights observer in Syria, Palestine, Jordan, and Egypt. And Hassan is a Canadian lawyer who's pursuing a Master's of Law degree at Berkeley Law. And again, they are volunteers with the International Refugee Assistance Project, or IRAP, representing refugees seeking resettlement in the U.S., and they traveled with four of their fellow Berkeley Law students to Beirut, Lebanon, in January to meet with Syrian refugees and to really learn what Syrian refugees in Lebanon were and are going through. What about the U.S.? There's a U.S. embassy in Lebanon, and I assume they could and they do conduct resettlement interviews for refugees who are referred for resettlement to the U.S. What's the situation there?
So the number of refugees that are allowed to come in to the U.S. every year is set by presidential mandate. Over the last several years, that quota has been 70,000 refugees, and this is from all over the world that the U.S. takes in. Unfortunately, the process for resettlement of Syrian refugees to the U.S. Has been frustrating to an extent. We had the opportunity to visit the International Catholic Migration Commission, which is a third-party organization that the U.S. government uses to facilitate the resettlement process for Syrian refugees who are in both Lebanon and in Turkey. Now, since resettlement interviews are only able to take place within the U.S. embassy, there's been a delay in this because currently the U.S. embassy is under construction in Beirut. So unfortunately, there have been no resettlement interviews for Syrian refugees wanting to resettle in the U.S. since August 2014. So that's a period of almost a year and a half where you have no Syrians that have undergone these resettlement interviews. Just some quick figures. In the fiscal year 2015, which was so the fiscal year runs from October to October in the resettlement process. So from October 2014 to October 2015, from Lebanon and Turkey, in sum, there was only 5,885 Syrian refugees that were resettled in the U.S., and the majority of which came from were Syrian refugees in Turkey. Now, when we spoke with the ICMC, the International Catholic Migration Commission, they advised us that the quota for fiscal year 2016 would be 11,000. Now, it's frustrating to see that you have many Syrians that sought refuge in Lebanon over a year ago and have been waiting for their resettlement interviews and still have not even started that process. And basically they're in this limbo in Lebanon, not having full citizenship status, being poor, and not knowing if they're going to be resettled to a third country.
What do you make of arguments by other nations that they don't have the resources to accommodate Syrian refugees, or that they're worried that refugees from that part of the world may pose security threats to their people?
Well, I think that European or U.S. officials who claim that they don't have the capacity to take in more Syrian refugees need only look at Lebanon for proof that that argument kind of falls flat on its face. In Lebanon, there's one Syrian refugee for every four Lebanese people. And I think most people would agree that Lebanon had far less of a capacity to deal with this influx than many other countries in Europe or the U.S. So when advocacy groups and others are calling on the United States to, for instance, increase the number of refugees they're taking to 75, 100,000, 200,000, compared to the U.S. population, these numbers are paltry in comparison to what Lebanon has taken. And as far as the security argument, I think that this is largely based on xenophobia and Islamophobia from people in Europe or the U.S., and that it hasn't been proven at all that influxes of Syrian refugees have caused any kind of instability or greater terroristic threat.
The argument that there's going to be greater security concerns if we allow Syrian refugees into Europe and the U.S. is simply baseless. There have been no documented cases in any type of numbers that Syrian refugees have caused any type of criminal acts or terrorist acts. People will point to things like the Paris attacks and say, well, look, this is an indication if we allow Syrian refugees into Europe, there's going to be more terrorist attacks. And people completely neglect the fact that none of the people who perpetrated those attacks were refugees. Those were all citizens of Europe. There were French and Belgian citizens who committed those attacks. I lived in Syria as a teenager, and I found Syrians to be like any other people, peaceful, loving people. And the majority of people that are fleeing the country are families and people just looking for a better life for themselves and their children.
And just one more thing on that, by eliminating the possibility for refugees to immigrate to safe countries via legal means, what the countries like Europe and the U.S. are doing is leaving refugees without an option but to travel to these countries in illegal means, which is what we've been seeing with the influx of refugees to Europe. As we've seen in countries like Lebanon, a lot of the families we interviewed have children with pressing medical needs, are just simply unable to sustain themselves in these countries because of a lack of resources. And a lot of these individuals' families come to IRAP to find out what their legal chances are to be able to resettle safely to a third country. And when they find out that the chances are just so slim, akin to winning the lottery, they have no other options but to get on a boat and cross the Mediterranean.
Your report, near the end of this report, this IRAP report, which is International Refugee Assistance Project report, based on your visit to Lebanon in January, it states that the outlook is bad, right? More refugees will enter Lebanon. There will be more labor exploitation, more illegal labor, further restrictions, harder to find housing, more debt, a rise in medical problems. It's kind of overwhelming. So I want to end by asking you both where you find hope, what you see as something positive that comes out of your trip or your understanding of the Syrian refugee crisis in Lebanon. What do you rely on so that you just don't get weighed down by the thought that, you know, this problem will get worse as more people enter Lebanon, which inevitably, it appears, will happen?
The one thing that gives me hope is, actually, there are two things that give me hope. Firstly, understanding that there have been refugee crises in the past and refugees have risen above that. I come from Canada and we had a huge influx of refugees that came from East Africa in the 1970s, some of whom are now the most prominent and wealthiest members of Canadian society now. So there are precedents where if we give the due regard to the international law that is there for refugees and allow refugees to resettle in third countries or to have a meaningful path to citizenships in the countries that they're seeking asylum, they can live successful lives. So that's the first thing. Secondly, many of us who visited the schools and spoke and interacted with the children, children are always a source of hope, and you see the future in them. And no matter how difficult it is, you know, you hope that they're able to overcome these circumstances and to forge a way for themselves in their generation and the societies that they're growing up in. Now, obviously, Syrian refugee children living in Lebanon face added difficulties, obviously starting over, starting fresh and being in an uncertain environment and not having their families, not having the means to provide them everything they deserve. But it's the human story at the end of the day that people overcome unimaginable difficulties in their lives. And that's what we hope for the Syrian refugees in Lebanon.
Yeah, I think one thing that people tend to forget when talking about refugees or working with refugees are most of these people really just want to go home. It gets lost when working with refugees in the resettlement process. But if you ask most of them, would you rather resettle to a third country like the United States or Europe, or would you rather go back to Syria? Overwhelmingly, they're going to say that they want to go back to Syria. They want to go back to the way things were. And what gives me hope is that one day the crisis in Syria will end. People will be able to return to their homes. And just until that time, I think the generosity of ordinary citizens is going to keep these people going until they can get back to their homes.
Tori Porel and Hassan Ahmed are both students at UC Berkeley School of Law, and they worked with IRAP. They work with IRAP, the International Refugee Assistance Project, and they were part of an IRAP Berkeley Law delegation that went to Beirut, Lebanon in January. And the report that came out of that visit to see the Syrian refugee situation up close and personal, the report that came out of that, we have a link to that report on our website, againstthegrain.org, as well as to the International Refugee Assistance Project and its Berkeley Law chapter. Tori, Hassan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.